dare you. Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. Our good friend, attorney Irwin Aronson, going to be here talking about the prevailing wage theft that the Republicans are attempting to pull off. Some of the other things that they are doing today. You know, you look at these folks and you go, what happened to the jobs? Where's the jobs thing? Where did they go wrong? How'd they get off the right track? You know, I was with them. Jobs. Let's talk about that. How do we do it? How do we create them? How do we encourage it? How do we build a community for workers to make a decent, sustainable living? How do we do those things? I'm with you. Let's do that. No, can't do that because they don't know how. They hate government, they hate everything about it, and they want to sell off everything that we have. Why? Because, well, they're going to profit from it. I don't know how else to put it. That's as simplistic as it can be. Because I can't think of any other rational reason. And I'd love to hear it if there is one. So we'll talk with Irwin in the first hour. In the second hour, Larry Handley's going to be here, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU, going to be here talking about the Occupy Wall Street and his union jointly declaring today a national day of action for jobs and mass transit. So we'll find out what events went on and, you know, where we should be going. I'm a huge fan of public transportation. A huge fan of light rail, a huge fan of dedicated buses. Why? Well, get more people off the highway, save more energy, just smart policy. But, you know, you got the right here who, hey, let's privatize what we got. Again, you know, it just drives me nuts. In the second hour, we'll also talk with Roland Wang, Program Director of Transportation at the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC.org, the website. Going to be here talking about gas prices. I mean, I just paid $3.99 on infinitum for a gallon of gas today. $4, you know, probably in a couple of days. You know, Memorial Day is coming up, so you'll see the bump up there. You know, could we hit $5 by summer? Interesting times. What should we be doing? Where should we be going? I don't know how much clearer that can be. Oil is not going to get any more plentiful. We're not going to be able to grow anymore. We're not going to be able to make it, bubble it underground anymore. What we have available is what's available. Drill, baby, drill has not worked. For a whole bunch of reasons, but we'll talk to Roland about that. In the third hour, Dr. Robert Whitehall is going to be here, assistant professor at the University of Rhode Island. Today is the anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, so we'll look at that. We'll look at the movement that he left behind that empowered a generation to demand equality. We'll see if that equality has been met and really find out what this generation's cause is going forward. You look at all of these marches and these rallies around the murder of Tayvon Martin. You know, the time is now to get to the streets. The time is now to begin to change things that haven't been. So we'll talk about that and a whole bunch of other things I'm ticked off about. Also, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you got thoughts, questions, comments, something on your mind, you can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. So today, CNN broke the news. I don't know that it was really news, but today, CNN, right on the front lines, on the cutting edge, they have declared that President Obama clinched the Democratic nomination. with his big primary wins in the District of Columbia and Maryland. So there you go. I don't know if there was any suspense there, but now we know. Obama is the Democratic nominee. I don't know that there was any doubt of that, but there anyway. So Dick Cheney yesterday was released from the hospital 10 days after his heart transplant. And now, thanks to the good folks over at the Philly Daily News, we now know where Cheney got his heart from. Took it from Tom Corbett, I guess. If you look at the front page of yesterday's, I think it was yesterday's Philly Daily News, there was Tin Man Tom right there on the front page. Because like the headline said, Corbett's war on poor kids shows he needs a heart. And you look at this budget, and we've talked about it extensively. You look at the fact that cutting welfare programs, cutting education, cutting programs for the poor, for the sick, the elderly, kicking 41,000 people off of adult basic, kicking kids off of Medicaid. You go, heart? No. The Tin Man's going, here, take mine. And really, I mean, if you look at what's going on, this November, the choices could not be clearer than they are right now. Look at what our governor stands for. Look at the priorities that he put forth. Look at the morality, if you will. Listen to Paul Ryan. Look at the budget that he put out. And you got Romney running around saying, oh, Paul's my guy. So the question I have is when this is all over on the Republican side, and I think after April 24th, eventually it ends and Romney is the candidate. How much remaking are we going to see of Mitt Romney? How much Etch-a-Sketch are we going to see? How much are they going to be able to wipe clear? I mean, because if you look at the budgets that the Republicans have put forth, you look at the platform that they have put forth, this is the 1% budget. This is the very wealthy getting very wealthier. And the poor getting, well, poorer. The priorities, though, were literally taking food from the mouths of children so that we can have tax cuts for big corporations. We can hand out 15 years of, from what I'm told now, the minimum is 15 years of free taxes for this cracker plant out in western PA. We won! We beat Ohio and West Virginia. I still want to know what we gave up. Because if you're looking at 15 years of tax abatement, plus everything else I'm sure that we've given up, what could that have done for people in this state? I mean, you look at their jobs plans. Their jobs plans are, let's let people pollute, let's deregulate, let's do all of the things that we've been doing for 30 years that got us to this point. I mean, that's really the priority. That's the jobs plan. Oh, and by the way, we need to cut government spending on social programs and cut government spending on education so that those jobs go away. So the people who are telling you they're the job creators are really the job destroyers. I mean, I think it's pretty simple. Look at their priorities. And last night you had this Robert Ehrlich. He was the former governor of Maryland, Republican. He was on CNN. And, you know, he's Romney's my guy. And go into this whole thing that, you know, when times comes around, you know, when we're moving towards the general election, then we'll see his real views. We'll see how he really feels about women. Isn't this what the last year and a half has been, vetting the candidate? Because then why did we go through this if he's just going to flip again? So Governor Ehrlich, who's he blaming? Well, he's blaming Democrats. Because, well, you know, the Democrats are pointing out the fact that the Republicans are nuts. And, of course, he blames Santorum. And I think the reason he blames Santorum is Santorum brought up the issue that he had to answer to. See, a lot of this primary, very, really unusual for Republicans. Because they were really thrust into answering a lot of questions. They were really thrust into saying the things out loud that they whisper to their donors in the back rooms. What they say in the little secret clubs. They now got to stand up and say, yes, I believe we should be taking contraception away from people. Oh, but we believe it's a religious issue. Nonsense. And I look at Romney and I go, you know, I don't know how you walk back from the things you've done. I don't know how you walk back from that stuff. Even though Ehrlich is saying it, his aides are saying it, his wife is saying it, he's going to change once he gets the nomination. Because, you know, then women will really see his views. Well, I think women are seeing the Republican Party's views. They've been the same views they've had for at least my lifetime. Only now they feel emboldened and really forced. I mean, the radical right of the party is pushing the Republican agenda, which is why I say sane, rational Republicans, if you can't change parties, you can't go somewhere where it's a little more rational, at least take yours back. At least try and convince them that, hey, you know, you're going a little nuts. So anyway, last night, the big hat trick for Romney. And I love CNN. The woman came out and said, well, you know, is it time now for Mitt Romney to stop paying attention to the other candidates? And I'm going, I thought he'd already done that. You know, but again, you know, stating the obvious, I think he's past that. He's now attacking Obama. And he spent all last night on his little speech that he gave that, you know, most of the minions didn't know what to applaud to. There was a span of like 2 minutes where there were like seven applause lines that nobody got. You know, the speech writer wrote it in there. Okay, this applause, and it didn't come, and he just kept moving right along. But he has this new little phrase, and you know, I'm sure, I don't know if it's new, but he really hammered on this government-centered society. And I'm going, wait a second, you mean education? That's a bad thing. You mean healthcare? That's a bad thing. I gotta be honest. I kind of chuckled when I listened to him. Because he had some really, really weird statements, like this one.
Now, I'm not naive enough to believe that free enterprise is the solution to all of our problems. But nor am I naive enough to doubt that it's one of the greatest forces for good this world has ever known. Free enterprise has done more to lift people out of poverty, to help build a strong middle class, to help educate our kids, and to make our lives better than all the programs of government combined.
Yeah. Private enterprise, greatest force for good. Yeah, keep spewing the line. Because they educated our children. And I'm going, hold on, did I miss something here? Because as I remember, public school was funded by taxpayers. Public school was something that we did as a society. I don't know that private enterprise had much to do with it. They're having a lot to do with it now, and they're having a lot to do with destroying it. But as I remember, not so much in the past. It's only now that we've cut their taxes so far and cut the taxes for the wealthy so far that we're now begging with our hand out to these corporations. Oh, please, will you advertise on our buses? And oh, will you put your ad for your company on our report cards? And oh, please advertise on our lockers and I mean, at what point do we just go, you know what, it's nuts? And I agree with Tim Geithner. I agree with the Treasury Secretary when he was speaking at the Economic Club today in Chicago, where he said that the Republican budget, the proposal that they've put out, is a recipe for decline. He said there's no economic or financial case using the fear of future deficits to cut as deeply into the core functions of government to weaken the safety net or fundamentally alter Medicare benefits as the Republican proposals do. Because there's no rational reason for it. Because if you do what they're saying they're going to do, if you cut, gut, and punish as much as they want, you end up having an economy that spirals downward. We've seen the loss of several hundred thousand public sector jobs, and they're giddy about that. Had we maintained those jobs, how much faster would the recovery have happened? But I guess those aren't real jobs. They don't pay real taxes, and they don't fund real schools, and they don't spend real money in the economy and take care of real families, I guess, according to our Republican friends. Amazing stuff. Anyway, your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. Stick around.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Working families at over 100 events today are calling on Congress to immediately repeal the sequester federal budget cuts. The cuts, totaling $1.2 trillion over 10 years, went into effect March 1st. The AFL-CIO says these cuts will cost 750,000 jobs, and Republican hostage takers are demanding more devastating budget cuts, slash more jobs, and cut programs that working people need to get back on their feet. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that working people across America have sacrificed enough in the form of lost jobs and furloughed pay. He says it's time for Congress to demand that corporations in the richest 2% pay their fair share. For a complete list of the events urging sequester repeal today, go to AmericaWantsToWork.org. As workers protest the sequestration cut, cleanup at nuclear-contaminated sites could be delayed by furloughs triggered by those cuts. Jesse Russell has more.
The sequester cuts are beginning to have an impact on the country's most contaminated nuclear site. More than 2,000 workers at Washington's Hanford Nuclear Reservation received notices this week telling them they'll start being placed on rotating furloughs. 250 workers at the site received pink slips. The furloughs directly impact non-unionized workers at the cleanup site. Due to their contracts, unionized staff have more of a say in how departments can make them take furlough days. Workers are currently removing toxic and radioactive waste from the site in advance of a new treatment facility being constructed. There are some concerns about cleanup being delayed due to a number of underground tanks that are leaking. Hanford is the country's largest cleanup operation, eating up a third of the nation's nuclear cleanup budget.
The SEIU, black immigrant activists, and racial justice organizations are rallying on Capitol Hill in Washington Wednesday to demand that the distinct needs of Caribbean and African immigrants be addressed in any forthcoming immigration reform. SEIU says black immigrants comprise approximately 10% of the foreign-born population, but have been forgotten in the immigration debate. An estimated 700 progressive African Americans and black immigrants from the Caribbean, Africa, Latin America, and throughout the globe will join Clergy United to Save and Heal in the rally. It's being called the Black Communities for Immigrant Justice Rally. U.S. Congresswoman Yvette Clark of New York will give a congressional briefing on the issue. After the rally, the black immigrants will visit key members of Congress working on the immigration reform issue. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing tall against a multinational corporate agenda. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Also, if you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast or get the Stitcher app for your smartphone and take the program on the go. So a couple of tweets that came across my desk. Joe Pitts, congressman, writes, individual mandate is like the center pole under a tent. If you pull it out, that whole system will collapse. So I guess he's saying that if we pull the individual mandate out, our entire healthcare system will collapse. Probably a good reason why to make sure that the individual mandate stays. Also, Stephen Miskin, Mike Terzai's press secretary, he says, Speaker Smith says smaller body would improve communication among members and would bring about real solutions to the state's problems. How about making it so small that it was just one guy? We could just have a dictator. That would probably be a lot easier, wouldn't it? Probably would. Anyway, I've got our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson, on the line. Erwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, good to be here. How are you, Rick?
I am good. So what do you think? Make the legislature so small, make the whole government so small that just one guy does it.
Well, I think that, you know, maybe we just eliminate everybody and turn it right over to the insurance industry and the oil industry and the Marcellus Shell industry and, you know, a couple of those people, because we know what's good for business is good for Pennsylvania.
Okay, if you're going there. So let me ask you, we've been following this prevailing wage theft thing that's going on. Where do we stand right now?
Well, where we stand right now is that it doesn't seem that the advocates of stealing wages from working people have enough votes to get their legislation passed, but we have to be ever vigilant. It's not going away. We have a hiatus today. Tomorrow's another day. They just seem to have an endless number of proposals to slash people's wages, to cut people's benefits, and to do it in the cynical name of taxpayer savings, when the one thing they've never done in any piece of legislation they've proposed is mandate any savings to taxpayers. Not one cent of guaranteed savings to taxpayers. All we have is a guarantee that we're going to cut people's wages. And somehow or another, the advocates of this, people like Representative Saylor, Representative Bayer, Representative Miller, Representative Perry, Representative and floor leader Terzai, every one of those people has the right to vote to cut their own fully financed taxpayer salaries. And they've never put up a vote for that. They've never even proposed legislation.
Yeah, like, and that. You would think that the Tea Party ones who came in because we're going to reform and we're going to destroy government, you would have thought that would have been one of the first pieces to come out of the radical right.
Well, you would think, and you would think that, you know, these people who refer to themselves as Tea Party would also be people who are advocating not a smaller legislature, but a larger legislature, so that it's closer to the taxpayers that they purport to represent, not farther away, not more distant. But cutting the size of the legislature by this particular crowd is exactly on beam with their voter suppression legislation that they passed a couple of weeks ago. These are two sides of one coin. First, we take away the right of people to vote. Then we take away their access to their government. And then we can put up votes all the time to slash people's wages, cut people's benefits, eliminate their job security, and in the process, of course, do things like compromise the health and safety of our children, our school teachers at public school buildings, compromise the health and safety of our firefighters, our professional firefighters in firehouses that are built with public funds, compromise everything that we hold dear, and not save anybody so much as a cent, and make the mistake that they want to have us lapse into, that they just want to raise the threshold. What they want to do is repeal the law, and if they can't repeal it wholesale, they'll repeal it a little bit at a time, right. Death by a thousand cuts. Increasing that threshold from the current unreasonably high $25,000, understand, that is exactly 1,250% higher than the federal threshold for prevailing wage applicability. Raising that from $25,000 to $185,000 would eliminate prevailing wage protection for taxpayers from something like 3,400 to 3,800 public service, public construction jobs every single year.
So walk us through this, because a lot of people that I talk to want to know, you know, let's say we raise this up. We raise it up to $185,000 or $200,000 or wherever they can get it. What does the world after that law, what does it look like? I mean, because I've taken the position that we're going to see patronage, we're going to see brother-in-laws, hey, my brother-in-law needs a job, I can do this. Walk us through this.
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, what it means is that the wages of the workers performing work that is financed in whole or in part by taxpayer funds that is estimated to be valued, pick that number, $185,000 or less, would not have any guarantee that they, even at a minimum, get the wages for their trades or their crafts for performing work on those jobs that prevail in their communities, that are most frequently paid in their communities. It means nothing in the way of taxpayer savings, because there's nothing in any of these bills that would require the wage cuts to be transmitted to the taxpayers. Instead, they would just be reallocating the money from the pockets of the people performing the work to the pockets of the people who are financing the work.
Have we seen this anywhere else? I mean, are there any other states that have gone through this that we can look to as examples?
Oh, there are several states that have gone through this. Utah repealed its prevailing wage law, and the effects were enormous and all but immediate. Ohio increased their threshold on their prevailing wage law, a different way of repeal, and the effects were potent and immediate. The first thing that happens is the training programs to give us our next generation of skilled construction workers fall apart, because part of what comes out of the prevailing wage are the totally private contributions from workers' paychecks that finance joint apprenticeship and training committees sponsored by labor and management in the construction industry that assures two things. One is that new people coming into the industry get the most efficient and most effective, highest level of training of anybody in the world. And second, that journey persons who are skilled craftspeople get training from those same training facilities for upgrading their crafts and staying current. I know that 35 years ago, plumbers and pipe fitters and heating, ventilating, and air conditioning construction workers were working with hand tools and installation of equipment. Today, many of them are working, doing balancing and setup in front of computer terminals, and they've had to learn new skills. People in the electrical trades, same kind of thing, where they're setting up elaborate communication systems now that didn't exist as recently as 10 years ago. And that training doesn't come from public schools. It doesn't come from even partially publicly financed community colleges or state universities. It comes from wholly privately financed joint apprenticeship and training committees in the construction industry. And what our experience was in Ohio, what our experience was in Utah, what the experience was in Kansas and in Oklahoma years ago when they repealed or partially repealed their prevailing wage laws, these training programs fell apart. The next thing that happens is that construction workers who do have these skills and these talents and these abilities in a mobile society move on.
Right.
And they go to places where they can earn a living, because when these prevailing wage laws are repealed or partially repealed, the impact is to depress wages, doesn't depress costs, doesn't limit costs, doesn't put a penny back in the hands of the taxpayers. But it does depress wages, and people who have skills, fortunately, are able to take those skills with them. And when they take those skills with them, they take them to places where they can earn a living to support their families, to have family-sustaining pay, to have family-protecting health care benefits, to have futures with meaningful pensions that allow people to retire after working in hard work, difficult situations, out in the cold, out in the heat, day in and day out. Over a career of 35 or 40 years, people's bodies do get beat up.
Right.
So a logical pension is another one of those kinds of things that people strive for. And if you can't get that in a state like Pennsylvania, because they artificially depress wages by passing these wage depression laws that finance by way of taxpayer funds are raised to the bottom, people move on. They vote with their feet and they go to other places. So those are devastating effects, and we can't get that back. We can't reacquire those training facilities that are really only privately financed and privately financed out of the pockets of construction workers. We can't get people back who have to move on. They don't come back, and we lose their children, our future, and we lose the contributions those children would make to our state when they get a decent education paid for because their parents had decent wages. And that's the cure for cancer that's just around the corner. That is the next Facebook or the next form of personal computer or the next telephone system or the next something that we have yet to dream of, that we're denied simply because some politician who could have done something did the wrong thing when given the opportunity.
Yeah, you know, but I look at these training programs, and again, you've said no taxpayer money goes into this. It's funded by the folks who are actually doing it, and I guess that's part of the problem, in my opinion. The right sees that as, well, something bad, because there's no profit there. There's no way to profit for them from that. They want to have these fly-by-night schools that they set up and charge a whole ton of money to the students for, and maybe they get jobs at the end and maybe they don't.
Well, I think you know one of the examples we see with great regularity is we have phony apprenticeship programs operating in Pennsylvania, even as you and I speak. They claim to be operating. Actually, they're sponsored by the ABC, the Associated Builders and Contractors. And their dropout rates, their incompletion rates are astounding compared to the ones that are operated jointly by contractors and unions who, through collective bargaining, create these private plans. And it is astounding to see how those things operate. But I think you might be right that just like with the phony charter school movement and the voucher programs put forward by the Corbett administration and others, and some are Democrats and some are Republicans, the majority seem to be Republicans, but the same people who seem to be sponsoring repeal or partial repeal of the Pennsylvania Prevailing Wage Act are people that are advocating expansion of charters and creation of vouchers. And there again, we have an educational platform that would be financed by the public, but aimed at putting profits into private players' pockets at the expense of our most important resource, our children.
Yep, because, I go back to when I was in school. Our high school had a machine shop, had an auto shop, had an electronic shop, had cosmetology and all these other different tracks students could take. All that's now wiped out, all gone. Now it's private. Now, if you want to do those things, you've got to go to this school and you've got to pay outside of what the public school used to offer.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, the public schools are being starved, particularly in the urban areas of Pennsylvania, because the money that should be going to have metal shop and cosmetology and electric shop and print shop and machine shop and wood shop class and things like that, along with school nurses and guidance counselors, has all been stolen from the school district operated schools so it can finance these phony charter schools that do nothing for anyone except the operators who are pocketing a lot of money instead of educating children. And the results, of course, are evident because we don't see any evidence whatsoever that the charter school students are getting a better education or performing better, but at the same time, we're not investing in our kids in a fashion that would have them be able to be contributing members of our society, because instead we're telling them that these options are no longer available to them. And oh, by the way, if they come to school sick, there's not a school nurse to help them out anymore. And if they want to contemplate college or alternatives to college, like entry into high-level building and construction trades training programs, there's no guidance counselor at the school anymore except every odd Thursday, because we've had to cut out the core of guidance counselors that were in the schools in order to pay for the charter schools that are stealing money from the taxpayers. So it's a vicious cycle, and I go off on what sounds to be tangents at times when I get the opportunity to be on this show, because the interrelationship of government, education, minimum wages, the quality of life and the quality of work, access to health care, access to pensions, access to the things upon which we as a society count for basic norms are so integrally interrelated, and they have such a direct touchstone with the political outcomes that we achieve or fail to achieve in the April 24th primary this year and, of course, in the November election this year. And the need for people to be involved in those electoral processes is not abstract and it's not distant. It is immediate and it is direct, because when the wrong people get elected, a lot of bad things happen to our wages, to our training, to our education, to our children, to our health care, to our retirement plans, to a whole host of things that are the norms of life in a great state like Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, the keystone of America.
Yeah, this is why this November is so important. Last question I've got for you on this. I've gotten a number of emails from people saying, but Rick, I know you're all in favor of this prevailing wage thing. I know you say it helps our communities, it helps the building projects, but I've heard that we can save, as taxpayers, 30 to 60% on these building projects. We can get this stuff almost for free. And you look at the head of the Tinky Tank over here, this Matt Briette, who's shoveling this stuff, and it doesn't seem to the people emailing me that thought has gone into this. They just buy it at face. We could save 60% if we just slash their wages enough.
Well, listen, we could save 100% if we could not only slash their wages, but compel everybody to be slaves like they were before 1865 in certain parts of the United States, and then we send them off into the Home Depots and Lowe's of the world, I guess, and have them steal all the building materials. Real world is, and we've talked about this in the past from time to time when this subject has come up in my visits to your show. The maximum highest estimate on commercial type construction that I have seen of labor cost as a function of total cost on a project is about 24%. That's the highest I've seen. So in order to cut 30%, the lowest number you mentioned, from the cost of a construction job, every worker on the job would not only have to work for free with no pay and no health insurance and no benefits and no Social Security and no workers' compensation protection, by the way, but they would actually have to pay 6% of their wages, of what their wages should have been, to the employer to put them on the job.
Now, that's business friendly. That's something I'm sure Mitt Romney could get behind.
Oh yeah, I think so. It sounds like Mittens and the folks who are closing ranks around him now just find that kind of idea to be music to their ears. But real world is that in order to cut 30% from the cost of a job based upon a reduction of the minimum wages paid, we would have to be able to demonstrate that the cost of labor on that job, this Matt Brulette guy who passes himself off as an economist, and I'm just a small town lawyer, I'm not an economist, we would have to be able to identify what the dollar per hour amount of wage cuts would be. So if somebody is making $20 an hour and you cut their wages based on a repeal or a partial repeal of prevailing wage law to $15 an hour, okay, you've cut their wages, of course, by 25%. But if their wages are a grand total of 30% of the job and you only cut 25% off of them, the most you could be saving is 2.5% on the cost of the job. So give me a break.
Yeah, that doesn't sound like much savings, especially when that money goes right into the local community.
Well, but it's not any savings because there's no guarantee, there's no requirement, there's not even a suggestion in this legislation that the money stolen out of the workers' paychecks would go back to the taxpayers. It's just reallocated into the pockets of people who are writing the paychecks. This is not savings. This is theft. Theft by any other name is still theft. And this is wage theft, the most offensive kind of crime, because we're compelling people to work and then taking away what they've earned for themselves and what they've earned for their employers. And we're putting it in the pockets of their employers. That's not socialism. That's not capitalism. That's communism. It's communism by the landed class against the people who are performing the work that creates the money that they have.
Which is why we need to be contacting our representatives and let them know, leave this alone.
Well, it's not to leave this alone. If, representative, if you want to be honest and you want to save taxpayers' money, I have a way. Okay, cut your own wages. That's a direct savings because 100 cents of every dollar paid to every legislator and every legislative staff member, 100 cents of every one of those dollars comes from taxpayers. And we know that if the taxpayers pay less, they'll save more. These people can't even trust themselves to deal with themselves, but they have somehow arrogated to themselves a right to cut my wages. And the members that I'm honored to represent cut their wages. That's outrageous. It's outrageous. It is beyond just a little bit offensive. This is a misplacement of our government. I don't believe one of our listeners, I don't believe that there is one construction worker anywhere in Pennsylvania that voted to elect anybody that's in the General Assembly today for the purpose of having that representative or that state senator exercise their very special power to cut the wages of their fellow Pennsylvanians.
I agree with you. I don't think there is anyone. And I again, that's why I say this November is so important. Erwin, great, always great talking with you. Always great having you on the program. I appreciate it.
Good to be here, and I'll be blessed if I get to talk to you again next week and talk some more about the future of Pennsylvania and how we can get it right.
Looking forward to it. Our good friend, Attorney Erwin Aronson. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Earth, sky. Wednesday, March 20th. The March 2013 equinox happens on March 20th at 11:02 Universal Time, which is 6:02 a.m. Central Daylight Time for us in the central U.S.
The March equinox signals the beginning of spring in the northern hemisphere and autumn in the southern hemisphere. The equinox represents a point on Earth's orbit, but it's also an event that happens on the imaginary dome of Earth's sky. It marks that special moment when the sun crosses the celestial equator, going from south to north.
The imaginary celestial equator is a great circle dividing the imaginary celestial sphere into its northern and southern hemispheres. The celestial equator wraps the sky directly above Earth's equator, and at the equinox today, the sun crosses the celestial equator to enter the sky's northern hemisphere. All these components are imaginary. Yet, what happens at every equinox is very real, as real as the sun's passage across the sky each day, and as real as the change of the seasons.
Our distant ancestors didn't understand equinoxes as events that occur in the course of Earth's yearly orbit around the sun. But if they were observant, they surely marked today as being midway between the sun's lowest path across the sky in winter and highest path across the sky in summer.
If they thought in terms of four directions, they might have also learned a fact of nature that occurs whenever there's an equinox. The sun rises due east and sets due west. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science. We're at earthsky.org.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
The Rick Smith Show.
Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give us a call. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. And I look at this. The only thing the Republican assault on prevailing wage is going to do is lower workers' wages, as Erwin pointed out. And the thing is, we were talking to someone just this morning when we were in Philly, talking about Indiana. And he was telling us that when Indiana rammed through this no rights at work agenda by pushing through the law that says that, well, you know, employers and workers and their unions, they can't agree to a security clause that says everybody who works there has to pay dues. What they did with the law is they said, well, anybody who had existing contracts, you could do that. So we're not gonna screw with that. But in the future. So basically putting the current companies at a disadvantage. That's by design. That's so that they can say, well, see, look, those unions put those companies out of business. It's all in the messaging. It's all by design what they're doing. But what he was telling us is when they went back to negotiate with these companies who had these security clauses in their contract, the companies were looking for massive wage cuts, saying, well, you want that? We want huge subsidies. We want more. We want something back. And again, you look at this and you go, it's all about stealing back from the workers that what was gained. And you know, I got an email from Jim, and he writes, I saw those 60 Minutes pieces you talked about last night, and I agree. Republicans can't have it both ways. He says they cannot continue to push for job killing privatization schemes and complain that unemployment is too high. He said, like you said, Obama does what they want, and they lambast him for it. They've been dying to privatize NASA so they can patent all of the advancements and the technology our tax dollars discover. Thanks for bringing this up. It is too important to ignore. And he's right. Look, Obama did what they wanted. He's privatized. Okay, we're going to privatize this part of NASA. And he did it. They went and they cut the rest of the funding. So this project down in Brevard County, Florida, where the Kennedy Space Center is, where 7,000 people lost their job because Obama cut their budget in half and Congress cut it off completely. So 7,000 people out of work, what they saw is, you know, a multiplier of probably 10 times that of jobs lost in the community. Because why? Well, the people who were making a decent wage, they don't have it anymore. And, you know, you look at this and you go, this frame that the Republicans keep throwing out here, well, government don't create no jobs. What about those 7,000 workers who were working at the Kennedy Space Center? And Brevard County is a perfect place to look. This is what happened when you took all of this money out of there. When you said, well, we're no longer going to do this. We're dumping all these people. And now, cut, slap, bang, done. The whole community collapsed. And you look at all the people who are left. Nobody. All of the businesses closed. If you look at the 60 Minutes piece, all of the businesses closed. The industrial parks are empty. The strip malls are empty. Even the people who had the foresight to start thinking about, well, what am I going to do when it closes? Because it was a possibility several years back. You know, a guy started a lawn cutting business and a sign business, only to realize that everybody's gone. You can't cut somebody's grass if the keys are hanging in the door for the mortgage company to come take. You can't put signs on billboards or on company fronts if there are no businesses there. And this is what the Republicans, they keep telling us they know how to create jobs. I heard Romney on and on and on. Oh, it's free enterprise, it's this or that. That's what creates jobs. No, smart investment, that creates jobs. A stable government, that helps create jobs. And you look at this story from this place in Florida where, you know, people who were working as engineers for 20-plus years, they can't get jobs as techs. They can't get entry-level jobs anywhere. And they went through a whole slew of people who, you know, never thought I'd be unemployed in my life. The one bankruptcy attorney they talked to said, you know, people are walking in here saying they're going to kill themselves because they can't find a job. And you look at the fact that the Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that more than 40% of the folks who are unemployed in this country have been unemployed for more than 6 months. And you look at the people that they were talking to. This happened 11 months ago. They have been unemployed for 11 months. They can't find anything. The one engineer they talked to said he's had 3 interviews in 11 months and no job offer. And what I find interesting is the New York Times had a piece recently that point out that mortality rates in the year after a worker loses his job are 50 to 100% higher than would have been expected or would have been otherwise. They said the effects on mortality hazards decline sharply over time, but even 20 years after displacement, they estimate that 10 to 15% increase in annual death hazards. They write, if such increases were sustained indefinitely, they would imply a loss in life expectancy of at least a year to a year and a half for a worker displaced at age 40. And you know, you go back and you look at all of this stuff. I mean, there are tons of studies that show that there are negative effects when people lose their jobs, especially for a long period of time, 11 months, a year, two. The fact that you're going to lose earnings over a lifetime, that's huge. the fact that your children are not going to be able to go to school and participate in other things, the fact that they're not going to see who is supposed to be the breadwinner out there doing that. It's a generational problem. And let's not forget the skill that they lose. You know, I don't know about you, but if you're not doing something, your skills do come down. And they're even saying that basic literacy goes down if you're not using it. Not to mention the Congressional Budget Office, their report that said the long-term unemployed shows higher rates of deteriorating mental and physical health. So I don't care where the jobs come from. Got to be honest, I don't. It's just that we need to get them. If government has to be the employer of last resort, that's what we need to do. We need to get people working. We need to get people with money in their pocket so that they spend it. This is a consumer economy. And then you'll have people serving that demand. Because, you know, as much as the Republicans are saying, well, you know, we need to get our deficits in order. We need to do this, this, and that. No, what you need to do is create demand. You need to get money in people's pocket. So when you're cutting food stamp programs, what's going to happen to the grocers? How many people are they going to have to lay off? If you're cutting unemployment benefits, what's going to happen to the electric company and to the banks when the mortgages aren't paid? There's a lot to this. Nothing is as simplistic as these folks on the right keep putting out. I mean, they're great at slapping a bumper sticker policy on, but that doesn't work. I mean, I love to hear them talk about the health care bill. It's 2,300 pages long. How did you think you were going to, how would you have done this? Could you do it in two pages like Herman Cain said we should do? I mean, is that the right way? Because I don't think so. And this whole idea, well, you know, free enterprise is the greatest thing in the whole world. Well, that's according to Mitt Romney. And I loved this statement.
Because when you attack business and you vilify success, you're going to have less business and less success.
Yeah, when you vilify business, you're going to have less business and less success. Nobody's really, I don't know that anyone's vilifying business. What people are saying is, look, they're not paying their share. The very wealthy are walking away from this nation. And even when companies do get into trouble, the workers are the first one to sacrifice, and the CEOs never do. And I look at this story that just popped, a story by Rachel Feinzeig. She's with the Dow Jones Daily Bankruptcy Review. Talking about this Hostess company who is a huge employer, who is filing bankruptcy. And now we find out, according to this report, that in the days before they filed bankruptcy, they'd already hired a bankruptcy attorney. They went and they changed the compensation structure of their executives from a merit-based system of, well, if the company does well, you'll do better. Your bonuses are based on performance. Because the right loves to talk about the meritocracy, don't they? Love to talk about, well, you know, those CEOs, they work hard, they do well, and they're valuable. And you look at the CEO of Hostess, this guy named Brian Driscoll. His salary was $750,000 plus a merit-based bonus. $750,000, I think you could live on that. I think you could live really, really well. You could live a CEO lifestyle. That puts you well into the 1%. And then with your merit, if you do really well, you work really hard, and the company does well, and the shareholders do well, and the workers do well, and the customers get good products, then you should get a bonus. And I agree. Yes, absolutely. Well, the company was nosediving because of the decisions these people like Driscoll made. So in the days and the weeks before the bankruptcy, according to the article, after they had already hired an attorney, they raised his salary up to $2.55 million, a 300% increase. They filled his pockets nicely. He's pretty happy. So now the people who are the unsecured creditors, they're saying, wait a second. That's not how it should be. We want an investigation into the bankruptcy case Because, look, we need somebody to be digging into this. We need to know what's going on because that's our money. And I agree, and this is where I wish the union, the Teamsters, and tomorrow when we talk to one of the Teamsters about this, I'm hoping that they're part of this, digging into this, because that's the workers' money. Because the workers at Hostess gave up huge, massive concessions over the years to keep that company afloat for years. They've been giving back, giving back, giving back. And now you turn around, you find out that these executives, their salaries, according to the article, were increased from 35 to 80%. Where's the meritocracy? Where's that world they keep telling us about? And I look at this and I say, you know, at some point we've got to wake up and realize that the pile that the Romneys of the world are pushing on us, that we need government out of everything, that free enterprise is the way to go, that's the best way. Here's a guy who made his money by basically bankrupting companies and charging huge, massive fees to navigate these companies through bankruptcy and basically put them under while benefiting himself. That's Romney world. That's the business world. And if the workers get screwed, well, so be it. My thought on the Hostess thing, and when we talk to whoever it is we talk to tomorrow from the Teamsters, I'm going to ask. You know, the reality is I'm looking at this, and there's a hearing set for April 17th. To me, it's all about setting aside the collective bargaining agreement. It's all about gutting the pensions and gutting the working conditions for workers. It's about throwing all that out so the company can then be like, well, like a Chinese company, if you will. Stop and think about that. One of the first things they want to do, they want to set aside that collective bargaining agreement. They want to set aside the rights of the workers. And part of me says, you know what? This was the plan all along. That these executives, they don't want to have to say, you know what, we're taking $2.55 million in compensation, or we're taking $3 or $10 million in compensation while paying basically minimum wage. They don't want to have to answer to anybody. And this is why people go, Rick, why are you such a big union supporter? This is the reason right here. This is it right here. Because when you get these CEOs taking a massive slice of the pie, there's got to be someone there. There's got to be a force that levels things out. There's got to be a force that brings wages and CEO compensation somewhere into balance. There's got to be that force. And I look at this Hostess situation. This was a screw job from top to bottom. This was these people going, oh, hey, we can run this company into the ground, kick those workers to the curb, and then we can really start making the profit by divvying things up, selling things off. I'm telling you, this plays right into the right-wing frame. Oh, it was the union who put these people out of business. Not anywhere close to that. But you look at this CEO, man, he got his 300% pay increase days before the bankruptcy. Days! You don't think they planned this out? You don't think they planned out every second how they could maximize every penny into their pockets while screwing the workers? You don't think that's what went on? If you don't think that, you're more naive than even Mitt Romney is. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show. It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Thanks for listening to The Rick Smith Show. We are currently currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening in Harrisburg and around the globe, be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Working families at over 100 events today are calling on Congress to immediately repeal the sequester federal budget cuts. The cuts, totaling $1.2 trillion over 10 years, went into effect March 1st. The AFL-CIO says these cuts will cost 750,000 jobs, and Republican hostage takers are demanding more devastating budget cuts that slash more jobs and cut programs that working people need to get back on their feet. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that working people across America have sacrificed enough in the form of lost jobs and furloughed pay. He says it's time for Congress to demand that the corporations in the richest 2% pay their fair share. For a complete list of the events urging sequester repeal today, go to AmericaWantsToWork.org. As workers protest the sequestration cuts, cleanup at nuclear-contaminated sites could be delayed by furloughs triggered by those cuts. Jesse Russell has more.
The sequester cuts are beginning to have an impact on the country's most contaminated nuclear site. More than 2,000 workers at Washington's Hanford Nuclear Reservation received notices this week telling them they'll start being placed on rotating furloughs. 250 workers at the site received pink slips. The furloughs directly impact non-unionized workers at the cleanup site. Due to their contracts, unionized staff have more of a say in how departments can make them take furlough days. The workers are currently removing toxic and radioactive waste from the site in advance of a new treatment facility being constructed. There are some concerns about cleanup being delayed due to a number of underground tanks that are leaking. Hanford is the country's largest cleanup operation, eating up a third of the nation's nuclear cleanup budget.
The SEIU, black immigrant activists, and racial justice organizations are rallying on Capitol Hill in Washington Wednesday to demand that the distinct needs of Caribbean and African immigrants be addressed in any forthcoming immigration reform. SEIU says black immigrants comprise approximately 10% of the foreign-born population, but have been forgotten in the immigration debate. An estimated 700 progressive African Americans and black immigrants from the Caribbean, Africa, Latin America, and throughout the globe will join Clergy United to Save and Heal in the rally. It's being called the Black Communities for Immigrant Justice Rally. U.S. Congresswoman Yvette Clark of New York will give a congressional briefing on the issue. After the rally, the black immigrants will visit key members of Congress working the immigration reform issue. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Today, the folks at Occupy Wall Street and the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU, they jointly declared this day a national day of action for jobs and mass transit in 20 cities across the nation. And I look at this and I go, it's about time. We need more people in the streets. We need more people talking about the issues that are important to us. And, you know, I go back to my childhood. You know, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and we weren't on the bus line. There was no opportunity. There was no way out unless you walked a couple miles down a busy road and got the rapid, down the road. But nothing came near. I'm a huge fan of public transportation because I think it opens up opportunities to so many people and gets people off the highways, saves energy, lots of good stuff. So I'm glad to see that today was the day of action. But here to talk to us about it and what happened in the 20 cities across the country is Larry Hanley. He's the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org, the website. Larry, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
You know, I look at these demonstrations across the country, these 20 cities, and I understand Pittsburgh was one of them. You know, you look at all the privatization that they're talking about here. Do you think this is waking people up?
I think it is. We had a really exciting day around the country. Matter of fact, some of the activities on the West Coast are still going on as we speak. But all across the country, in all four corners of America and in the heartland, we had activities that were jointly sponsored by Occupy and by the ATU, and other unions participated as well. And, you know, this is a step, but it was a really big step for us in that, you know, so many people got involved. Thousands of workers got involved with thousands of Occupy folks, and a whole lot of pastors were contacted today.
Yeah, I mean, yesterday we were at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference put on by the Blue-Green Alliance, and we had the opportunity to talk about, you know, people up in Massachusetts who are getting the riders together and getting the consumers together and saying, hey, you know what, we want better schedules, we want an expanded service base. And I know I've been hoping for that across the nation, some kind of a movement to link up the entire nation so that I can do like my wife did in Europe and go from one end of the country to the other, using public transportation.
Well, you know, you used to be able to, you know, until the 1950s, there were trolley systems that spread across the United States, and you could travel from the eastern seaboard, certainly out to the Mississippi River, just by jumping from one trolley system to another. And that, of course, was dismantled by General Motors and a whole cabal that bought up the trolley lines and paved a lot of highways in order to get people into cars and addict the Americans to gasoline usage.
You know, I look at this, and, you know, being today the day that the anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, you know, one of the things he fought for were, you know, better paying jobs and access to jobs for poor people. And like I said at the beginning, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. We were not on the bus line. We were not, we didn't have the ability for most of us to get to the jobs that were in the suburbs or in the industrial parks, because the industrial parks, they weren't on the bus line either.
Well, that's more and more true now, as service has been curtailed across the country over the last 2 years. There are lots of Americans who have been denied access to transit that they had 2 years ago. But also, you know, the whole point about Dr. King, you know, Occupy Boston came up with the idea for setting aside April 4th as a day for transit action. And they did so, according to them, because first of his historic speech on April 4th, 1967, where he broke with Lyndon Johnson on the question of the Vietnam War. And that speech came 1 year to the day before his murder in Memphis. And in that speech, he really talked about the fact that the war itself was an enemy of the poor people here in this country, because the lavish amount of money that was being spent on armaments and on war was actually starving America's poor and starving our cities. And Occupy Boston came up with this idea, first because the problems are so similar today to what they were in 1967, but then also because it also marks the day that Dr. King was murdered in 1968. And so these are some very concrete ways for us to live the legacy of Dr. King.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. But let's talk about how do we push this now? I mean, you've had this day of action. How do you get folks who may never take public transportation to say, yeah, it's a good thing and it's something that it's a public right, it's a public good, and we should be pursuing it?
Well, as you heard from our people from Fall River in New Bedford, Massachusetts, at the conference you were at in Philadelphia, the ATU is working through our local affiliates all over the country to build a national network of passenger organizations. We are working side by side with faith-based groups, many non-government organizations, nonprofits. And matter of fact, this is an exclusive. I can announce that we have started our own nonprofit for the express purpose of organizing passengers on buses and trains throughout the country. And we just did that last week. So we saw what happened today in more than 20 cities in America as a step in that direction. We are headed toward organizing riders all over America to stand up and fight for their systems.
And to have a say in how the systems are being used and what routes. Because I think the people should be the ones who are saying, hey, these are where we want to be going. This is the direction. This weekend, I had the opportunity to talk to one of the pastor at my church. She's from Germany, and her husband and her whole family came over for a 2-year kind of learning session. And he was telling me about the transportation system in Germany, how, you know, it's everywhere. I mean, at all times of the day, it's that convenient, and it's just they take it for granted now.
Well, you know, in many ways that was true here in the United States until after World War II. And with the Eisenhower Highway Program that occurred, you know, beginning in the 50s and then extending right to the 1980s, the federal government really poked its hand into transportation policy and created the suburbs and created a need for people to have cars to get to remote places, and they created urban sprawl. And, you know, at the same time, they neglected mass transit, and some of the people involved in the highway lobby actually went out and dismantled systems that existed. So now we're in a position where, in the next 20 years, more and more people are projected to be living in urban America, and they need a transit system to get them around. We need mobility. So we have to get a reordering of all the priorities in this country to match some of the stuff you're talking about in Europe, where, you know, where people, because of, you know, the way Europe developed and the fact that Europeans tax gasoline, for example, at a much higher level, and it's much more expensive to drive, people simply have learned to use mass transit, and they're very happy with it.
Yeah, he was telling me that they actually moved by using the train. They actually moved all their stuff, put it on the train, and they have special cars for that. And, you know, it's something that you can arrange. And I was impressed by what he was telling me. But I look at this, and I see this as an opportunity for our nation to not only get into the 21st century, but also create jobs and move us forward and pick up our economy.
Sure. And, you know, the thing is, too, people say that Americans are in love with their cars. I don't think that's true. It's just they hate the alternative. And the alternative has been made what it is in large measure by the industries that were profiting from highways and that type of development, including, you know, people who want to construct homes in suburbs and so forth. And as we start to lobby with passengers all over the country, we think we can actually dramatically change the dialogue. And part of what we intend to do is to point out some of the things you're talking about the way people around the world get around. And the fact that you don't need to have a car. It's just, you know, you need a car based upon the fact that you don't have many alternatives.
Right, and that's the big thing. And then you're stuck buying gas at $4 a gallon because there is no alternative. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Larry Hanley, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Larry Hanley's name. It'll take you right there. You know, I keep hearing, you know, people talk about, it's not profitable. Public transportation, which is not profitable. Companies can't make money off of it, so they're not going to do it. And I've got a couple of different thoughts on this. One, I think if you did it right, you could probably break even and make a little bit of money. But two, I look at the public good in it. And I think I look at Europe, according to my friend Mateus, they don't make money. It's subsidized by the government because it is a public good. That's the way it's seen there. Is it possible to run it as a profit, or do you think it's a public good like I do?
Well, it is extremely difficult to run transit at a profit because one of the things you want to do is keep the fare, the part of the expense that people pay to get on it, the boarded, low enough to make it competitive with the automobile. But, you know, the problem viewing it as it must be profitable is we would not say that about the fire department or about the police department. But any other public service, we wouldn't say, well, that service as a standalone has to be profitable because we recognize it as a service. But the way transit has evolved in this country, despite the fact that it is a service, people don't consider the fact that it's a service to the whole community and it need not make a profit.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. I think it's a public, it's part of the commons, it's part of what we should be doing just to move people around to help, and also to help businesses get their workers to work on time and all of that. So let me ask you, you know, in looking at the states around the country, are there any states that you think are committed to public transportation that are moving in the right direction that maybe we can use as a model?
There are very few. There are places, for example, Salt Lake City, there's a great deal of transit development and a lot of forward-thinking people. Which may sound odd, you know, that Utah would be a leader in transit, but there is a lot going on there. There are other places that are, but for the most part, the states are faking it also. Even in New York, which is the most transit-dependent state in the country, just last week, the legislature came out with a package that will fund mass transit growth or system capital needs for the next 5 years. And what was hidden in the details is that they're actually bonding billion dollars to fund it over that period of time. Now, what that means is that the state is not investing that $7 billion in transit. Instead, they're permitting the MTA to borrow an additional $7 billion. And this is a big part of the problem in that transit systems around the country are now choking from debt service, just like the arguments about the national debt. Many of our transit systems are currently paying huge debts for system build-outs that happened in the last 20 years. So those bonds are coming due. The interest is very high, and our operating budgets are being strangled by the fact that states and cities, rather than simply investing in these systems, often just authorize them to borrow. And that's something that has to be really thought through. It's time that, as America looks forward, we look forward with a vision, and we start thinking about how we can create more mobility in our cities. That requires investment.
Yeah.
And frankly, the amount of money we're investing, and this is really where the tie-in to Dr. King on April 4th comes in, with the amount of money we're investing in armaments to attack other countries, you know, with a very small portion of it. If we shut these wars down for 1 week, we could fully reduce all the fare increases and all the service cuts in America over the last 2 years.
Wow. I mean, when you put it in that kind of light, you wonder what we're doing over there in the sandbox. And I've questioned it from the very beginning. You go back to the guns or butter argument, and we're spending a lot of money on guns, not so much on butter and investing in the country. You made an interesting point there about vision. You know, because I've been saying the problem with what's going on is we don't have leaders who have vision. Our leaders seem to be looking to the next election and not what's going to happen 10 or 15 or 20 years down the road. There doesn't seem to be that kind of forward thinking in our government.
That's right. And that's one of the things we're battling. And that's why, from the ATU perspective, while we have not abandoned by any means being involved directly in electoral politics, our view is in the long run, the best place for us to be is organizing the people who ride the systems, because they are getting screwed. And some of the things that have happened at a time, and I know we've talked about this before, Rick, but at a time when there's a national consensus that we can't raise taxes, people who ride transit have had their fares skyrocket over the course of the last 2 years, and that's a tax, and
yeah,
they have been singled out.
But, Larry, those are just those working people. Those are just those people down at the bottom. We nobody really cares about them.
Well, that's the problem. And that's why there's such great synergy, frankly, between the people that run the transit systems. I mean, the people that actually work on them, the ATU members, and TWU members also, and the Occupy movement. Because, you know, the one thing that the Occupy movement did is it took this whole atmospheric discussion to a different level. You know, let's take my union as an example. All across our country, my members and officers are struggling in bargaining at the contract table, and they're bogged down often fighting over just trying to keep the little that they have.
Yep.
And if they, as a group, don't understand that this battle is national, it's really not local. You know, this is not a Pittsburgh problem. This is an American problem. This is actually a global problem. Then it's much harder to fight. But as we start to get a view of where the problem comes from, it enables us to build the kinds of coalitions that can actually successfully fight back.
So our listeners, what can we do? What can the people listening to this program do? How can they get involved to push this forward and to make, you know, here I would love to have a Corridor 1 project that they've been talking about for years and years and years, which is a light rail from Carlisle to Harrisburg that, you know, the county commissioners tell me is never going to happen because, well, it would cost too much. What do we do? What advice do you give people to come together?
Well, first they can go to ATU.org and they can sign on to a letter that will go to your member of Congress, and then the instant you just sign on the internet and the letter, it goes off. But also, you know, contact our union if you're in a city where there's an ATU. Basically, there are probably 14 different cities in Pennsylvania, for example, where the ATU is located. We're all over the country in just about every major city. And we want to work with our passengers and with the community. So we'll be there to work with you.
And we've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Larry Handley's name. He is the president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org, the website. Larry, it's great talking with you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, have a great night. Let's take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to the Rick Smith Show.
Thanks for listening to the Rick Smith Show. We are currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening in Harrisburg and around the globe, be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Rick Smith Show.
Buy the stuff you love with retailers' credit cards. Ditch their high interest rates with the help of PSECU. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/Visa for complete program details. Whatever new stuff you bought last year with retailers' high-interest credit cards, let PSECU help you get a fresh new start. Move those balances to the PSECU Visa with no transfer fee and a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through December 31st, 2014. PSECU. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit PSECU.com/Visa for complete program details. This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Apparently, Representative Paul Ryan missed the outcome of last November's presidential election. Oh, wait, wasn't he on the ballot in that election as Mitt Romney's running mate? Well, yes, but less than 5 months later, Ryan seems to have forgotten that he and the Mitster were soundly rejected. Maybe the trauma of losing, including losing his own hometown of Janesville, Wisconsin, has caused his memory slippage. Whatever the cause, it's embarrassing to see him now trotting out the very same Republican budget proposal that he wrote last year and put at the center of the Romney-Ryan national campaign. The same nauseating budget extremism that induced the great majority of Americans to upchuck. Ryan recently headlined a Washington media event for the re-release of this bucket of right-wing hash. It includes turning Medicare into a we-don't-care privatized voucher system that would deliver seniors into the tender clutches of giant insurance corporations, forcing the elderly to pay more for less. Also, in order to save the superbridge from even the slightest tax increase, Ryan again serves up a mess of cuts to food stamps, Medicaid, and other vital programs for the poor, while simultaneously jacking up the tax burden on both the poor and the middle class. Then, to make his package even more odious to the general public, he cluelessly reissues the far-right's cry to repeal Obamacare. Hello, Paul. Reality calling. Obama thoroughly thumped you and Mitt on this issue last year. Remember? And since the election, Obamacare has grown in popularity, with several Republican governors now seeing the political light and embracing Obama's signature health care reform. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time for family and friends to circle around Paul Ryan for a sanity intervention, gently trying to pull him out of the rabbit hole he's got himself stuck in.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
We don't get it! Shut it down! If we don't get it! Shut it down! We don't get it! Shut it down! If we don't get it! Shut it down!
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website. Or if you've got a smartphone, get the Stitcher app. Stitcher, Stitcher, Stitcher. Take the program on the go. You know, you listen to Larry Handley, and look, I'm as I've said before, I'm a huge fan of public transportation. I think there needs to be an alternative. I think that there were a viable alternative. Right now, with $4 a gallon, you'd be seeing more people taking public transportation. And that'd be going, that'd be telling all of the people who are raising the price up, the speculators, who are betting on, well, consumption's gonna keep going up because people gotta get to work, that there's an alternative. And I think you would see prices come down. But there's no alternative. I mean, we live in that world. Sad, sad stuff. So get involved, active, educated, informed, agitated. Get out there. It is, yeah, now's the time. You know, you look at the Tea Party. The Tea Party, they were out there screaming and hollering, and nobody stood up against them. Nobody whatsoever. We need to be that voice now. My quote of the day comes from Newt Gingrich. After getting thumped last night, he said that to defeat President Obama and change Washington, our party must commit itself to a bold, conservative platform. He says we cannot win on an etch-and-sketch platform that shows no principle or backbone. The Washington establishment wants to declare the race over, but I am confident to carry the banner of bold, conservative colors all the way to Tampa to ensure the Republican Party never abandons the timeless conservative principles of Ronnie and the contract with America. You gotta love Nooter's delusion. You gotta love it. And what I really like is he's gonna continue to be a thorn in the side of Romney, as will Santorum. You need those thorns. You need those people on their side of the fence throwing out what is obvious, and that is that these are not the candidates of the rest of us. Romney is full bore, one of the 1%, and unabashedly one of the 1%. Nobody doesn't try to explain away that he's going to have a car elevator so he can park his numerous vehicles and his wife's couple of Cadillacs, in multiple levels. You need a car elevator. I mean, how wealthy do you have to have a car elevator? Just a thought. Anyway, got an email this week from Ken. And Ken is a pro-union guy. Now, he sent me this email telling me the story of what's going on in Asheville, North Carolina at this Seidel Corporation. Evidently, the workers decided that, you know what, the bathroom facilities are, well, let's just say lacking. And they went to the employer and said, hey, we'd like you to do something about that. And the company basically told them to go pound salt, from what I'm told. So what they did is they began to organize a union. Said, you know what, we want to have some say in our conditions. So instead of dealing with them, trying to work through it, because, you know, good management, employee relations, that's the harmony you want to have a good environment. You would just fix them. You would maybe just say, hey, we'll work through this. No. What they do, they ran out and they hired the second largest union busting firm in the country. And what had begun, Ken says, as an indigenous innocent effort by 57 people to make a difference in their workplace, just by signing this informal letter protesting the bathroom conditions, was met with force, the kind of force you would imagine in a third world repressive totalitarian regime. And the company started holding captive audience meetings, holding people, then narrowing it down and having individual meetings with people. All the things we've been talking about, all the things I've been telling you is going on out there. And what really caught my attention here, and I'm just going to read part of his email because it really grabbed me. It's, you know what, maybe this downturn is waking people up. Maybe the conditions are getting bad enough where people are going to start to wake up. He says, ironically, he said, I spent the better part of 30 years as a manager in the transportation industry. He said, I butted heads with Teamsters for years. He said, if anyone had told me 6 months ago, I'd be smack dab in the middle of trying to organize my company. He said, I would have laughed at them. But then, I've never been a member of the working poor either. And I look at this, and just that statement to me speaks volumes. The fact that here was this guy who, you know, he was living the dream, man. He was probably lower middle management. You know, he saw the next office up. He saw, oh, I'm going to climb. I'm going places. And then the recession hits. And then people start losing their jobs. They start losing their homes. And I'm hoping that as people are being mistreated in the workplace right now, because they can be, because the economy is still not that great. You still hear employers taking wages back, benefits back, conditions worsening. We keep hearing these stories. But I'm hoping that as, you know, people are taking it because they have to. But as things get a little bit better, people say, you know what? We remembered when things were bad. And they start to organize, and they start to, like this guy, who 6 months ago, like he says, he would have laughed at you if you said he'd have been in an organizing campaign. Now he sees. Now his eyes are open. Now he realizes that this is the way you make your lives better. This is the way you make your conditions better. This is the way you make your wages and benefits better. By collectively bargaining, which is why the radical right is so hell-bent on destroying collective bargaining. And I look at this, and what's amazing to me about this story is that the company took the most bizarre turn against their employees. Because it makes no sense to me. If your employees come and say, you know, our bathroom conditions are pretty horrible, can you fix those? You fix them. But this company didn't. They said, no, you, how dare you question us? This is a feudal kingdom, and we are lords. You don't question us. And if you do, we're going to make your lives miserable. We're going to hold you in captive meetings. We're going to threaten you. We're going to threaten your families. We're going to threaten your livelihood. Because that's what they do in these things, man. Simple stuff. And he finishes up with, you know, here they are months later. And they're almost done repairing the bathrooms. Couldn't they have just done that from the beginning? But I'm gonna follow up on this, because I want to get somebody to talk about this, because that line that he said, you know, I've never been a member of the working poor until now, and now the light bulb goes on. Now I get it. I'm telling you, I'm hoping we all have that moment, and I'm hoping we all get it. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Thanks for listening to The Rick Smith Show. We are currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening in Harrisburg and around the globe, be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Rick Smith Show.
Apparently, Representative Paul Ryan missed the outcome of last November's presidential election. Oh, wait, wasn't he on the ballot in that election as Mitt Romney's running mate? Well, yes, but less than 5 months later, Ryan seems to have forgotten that he and the Mitster were soundly rejected. Maybe the trauma of losing, including losing his own hometown of Janesville, Wisconsin, has caused his memory slippage. Whatever the cause, it's embarrassing to see him now trotting out the very same Republican budget proposal that he wrote last year and put at the center of the Romney-Ryan national campaign. The same nauseating budget extremism that induced the great majority of Americans to upchuck. Ryan recently headlined a Washington media event for the re-release of this bucket of right-wing hash. It includes turning Medicare into a we-don't-care privatized voucher system that would deliver seniors into the tender clutches of giant insurance corporations, forcing the elderly to pay more for less. Also, In order to save the Superbridge from even the slightest tax increase, Ryan again serves up a mess of cuts to food stamps, Medicaid, and other vital programs for the poor, while simultaneously jacking up the tax burden on both the poor and the middle class. Then, to make his package even more odious to the general public, he cluelessly reissues the far-right's cry to repeal Obamacare. Hello, Paul. Reality calling. Obama thoroughly thumped you and Mitt on this issue last year, remember? And since the election, Obamacare has grown in popularity, with several Republican governors now seeing the political light and embracing Obama's signature health care reform. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time for family and friends to circle around Paul Ryan for a sanity intervention, gently trying to pull him out of the rabbit hole he's got himself stuck in.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Is now turning me into an unofficial Southerner, and I'm learning to say y'all, and I like grits, and the things are strange, things are happening to me.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So on the way back from Philly today, we were at the Good Jobs, Green Jobs Conference there in Philly this morning. And as we're driving back, I had to stop for gas at $3.99. And I'm going, you know, we're a penny away, just a microbe of a penny away from $4. You know, with Memorial Day coming around the corner, could we hit $5? I mean, are things going to get that bad? What's it going to take? What's it going to take for us to wake up? Yesterday we spent a good portion of the program talking about mass transit. How do we have an alternative? Because right now you want to get to work. There's no alternative. It's Tina time. You have to drive or, you know, maybe walk. We need to do something, which is why I've asked Roland Huang. He is the Transportation Program Director over at the NRDC. Roland, thanks for taking time for me.
Thank you for having me on your show, Rick.
You know, I look at this, almost $4 a gallon right now. I'm sure it's probably going to go up as the days near Memorial Day, and I look at what our legislature has done here in Pennsylvania, and it's, well, nothing.
Well, it's absolutely frustrating, and, you know, I hate to tell you this, but in Pennsylvania, you're probably lucky that it's not over $4 a gallon gasoline like it is in many parts of the country. We know that what doesn't work, and we know what the oil industry is trying to tell us and their allies. They're trying to tell us that more drilling in the United States will help alleviate gasoline prices. The fact of the matter is that we're drilling more than we ever have in the last 8 years. We're drilling more than we did under the Bush administration. The United States has 2,000 oil rigs, more than the rest of the world combined. The bottom line is we've drilled, baby, drilled, and it has done nothing, absolutely nothing, to reduce the price of oil and gasoline. What it has done, it has enriched the oil industry, the big five oil majors, ExxonMobil, Shell, Chevron, British Petroleum, ConocoPhillips, made $137 billion in profit last year. And we have senators in Congress who are refusing to take away $2 billion in oil industry subsidies. In fact, in your state of Pennsylvania, Senator Pat Toomey voted against ending $2 billion in subsidies. Actually, Senator Casey voted for such and voted for taking those oil subsidies away and giving it to clean energy, such as fuel efficiency and alternative fuels.
Well, I mean, that's the reason I'm going to vote for Casey, and I would vote against Toomey. You know, but I look at this, and what's frustrating to me on so many levels is, you know, I keep hearing my conservative friends saying, well, you know, they need those subsidies because, you know, they're a fragile industry. And I'm going, what are you talking about? $137 billion in profit. The Tea Party people were talking about redistribution of wealth and claiming that I want to redistribute wealth, which I do. This is a massive redistribution of wealth from me and people like me and all of my listeners who work for a living and have to drive to work and back. It's a massive redistribution of wealth.
Yeah, that's exactly right. In the state of Pennsylvania, drivers are consuming about 5 billion gallons of gasoline every year. And at $4 a gallon gasoline, that means $20 billion this year you could end up spending on gasoline in Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Oil companies are making enormous profits. In 2011, $137 billion, and that's a 75% increase over their 2010 profits. 75% increase, while the rest of us are suffering through a recession. These folks are helping themselves to a windfall profits. $2 billion in subsidies, which is Senate Bill S-2204, would have taken away those subsidies. It's really hard for anybody with a straight face to say that an oil industry, any industry, is making $137 billion in profit, can't afford to absorb $2 billion in federal reductions in subsidies. There's absolutely no reason why these should be continued. And even oil industry experts, even the head economists at the American Petroleum Institute and heads of major oil companies have testified in front of Congress saying they don't need these subsidies. So it's boggling, it's baffling why anybody in Congress would want to defend these subsidies. They're just not necessary.
It doesn't make any sense. But, you know, I look at, you know, the what I'm being told is, well, you know, the Obama administration's policies, they're strangling this industry and they're raising the price of gas. So what I'm hearing is it's Obama's fault. Why are gas prices so high? Because, you know, I don't think the president has that much control other than maybe to open the reserve once or twice to try and, you know, just shock the system a little bit. But I don't think he has that much control.
That's absolutely right. If you ask any reputable oil expert, they will tell you there's nothing the United States can do to lower oil prices. Oil prices are set by the world oil market. The United States has 2% of the world oil reserves, and we consume 20% of the world's oil. No matter how much we drill, it's just going to be a drop in the bucket in terms of the total global oil production and consumption. So we can't really do anything in this country. But what we can do is reduce fuel bills. We can give people options to buy fuel-efficient vehicles or electric vehicles or other alternative fuel vehicles. And as you were saying earlier, we can give people more choices to ride mass transit or live in communities where they don't have to drive so much, be so dependent upon automobiles. The House plan, when it comes, whether it's a transportation bill or whether it's, you know, whether it's energy bills, the House Republican plan is almost single-minded. Drill, 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 drill all the time, drill everywhere, you know, no matter what the solution is drilling. We know that doesn't work, and we know that just makes the oil company richer. We know what we really need to do is provide more choices. The House Republicans, on that, when it comes to transport, funding our transportation system, want to cut for mass transit. They oppose the new fuel efficiency standards that the Obama administration has proposed. Again, all their solutions revolve around more drilling, and the end result is more profits for the oil companies.
Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're here with Roland Wang. He is the Program Director of Transportation over at the NRDC. And, you know, you bring up an interesting point because I remember Rick Perry, when he was remembering that he was running for president, saying that we were going to get off foreign oil if we could just get that Canadian oil to come here to the U.S., which is kind of funny. Would drilling, would building the pipeline, do you think the Keystone XL, would that help at all here in the U.S.? And if, let's say, even my idea of I could support it if you built it to Chicago and stopped and then mandated everything that came through had to stay in the U.S., would that even drop our price any?
Well, with the Keystone XL pipeline from the Midwest border to the Gulf, which is what the Canadians want the United States to build, the truth of the matter is that's a pipeline through the United States, not to the United States. The way that it is currently planned, it's only going to benefit Canadian oil producers. And interestingly enough, because essentially what that pipeline will do is give landlocked Canadian tar sand oil access to a global market. They don't have that ability right now. They need access to a global market. And on the global market, their oil will go to the highest bidder, whether that's China, whether that's Europe, or whether that's Japan.
Or Wall Street.
The end result is that actually oil price, the price for Canadian oil for American drivers will go up rather than down. It's the Canadian XL pipeline is a pipeline to benefit Canadian tar sand producers. It doesn't benefit and actually hurts U.S. Oil prices.
Nice. So let's look at it from my perspective, where I could support it. Let's say that we only allowed them to build it to Chicago. They said, okay, you can do that. We can access that stuff. You can only bring it to Chicago, and it has to stay in the U.S. Would that bring down our price substantially?
No, because right now there's no problems with a pipeline capacity to do, already sell into the Chicago area. They already sell into that Midwest refinery area. They have plenty of capacity to do so currently with the current pipelines that are already in place. The Keystone XL pipeline actually would be a pipeline that's parallel to an existing pipeline. What the Canadians really want to do is build this massively oversized pipeline so that they can ship this older oil down to the Gulf, and that they have extra capacity so they can continue to expand their tar sands production, which is basically the world's dirtiest way of extracting oil. It's really a horrendously dirty, polluting, it destroys all kinds of ecosystems. It pollutes the water for the native population. It's a very horrendous type operation.
So would we
only going to help the Canadian tar sand producers?
So would it create? Let's say we did it. Would it create jobs in refining, or do you think we would just end up taking it through and putting it on tankers and shipping it out? Because as I understand, where they want to build it to is actually like a free trade zone, where we couldn't even tax it there.
Yeah, building pipelines is at best a temporary benefit in terms of jobs.
I mean, the refining capacity. I mean, would we? Do they even have to refine it here? Couldn't they just ship it right through and refine it somewhere else?
That's absolutely right. In fact, a lot of the tar sands would already be upgraded in Canada, and then they would they can ship it right through the United through the U.S. The better way to go, of course, is there are plenty of opportunities for the U.S. to invest in clean energy and create jobs through clean energy. For example, the Obama administration is about to finalize this summer a fuel efficiency standard of 54.5 miles per gallon by 2025, a doubling of fuel economy levels from today's levels. We estimate over the next two decades this 54.5 MPG standard would allow us to avoid spending $350 billion in oil imported from other countries, including Canada. Instead, that money would be invested back into the United States in manufacturing fuel-efficient vehicles of the future. And additionally, there would be $200 billion back into the pocketbooks of American consumers, American households through fuel savings, and they can spend that back into the U.S. economy.
And that would be a massive stimulus.
Essentially it's a $500 billion stimulus. You have $300 billion, which you will put into the U.S. manufacturing industry in the Midwest and elsewhere for clean cars, and you would bet $200 billion back into the pocketbooks of American consumers rather than giving that money to big oil companies.
Yeah, the way you've laid this out, I don't understand why there's anyone on the radical right who's against this. I mean, you're talking about creating jobs, you're talking about putting money back in consumers' pockets, you're talking about growing the U.S. economy. What's the hang-up?
Well, you know, it's baffling to us, too, because in our mind, it's overwhelming benefits associated with the clean energy approach, and there's no benefit only to the big oil companies when it comes to policies that many of the Republicans support, which is basically, again, drill, drill, drill is all their solution. It's not surprising that some of your listeners may not be surprised that the oil industry, oil and gas industry, has given nearly $223 million to Republican candidates for office.
Yep.
Since 1990.
Yeah, and I just saw a whole ad campaign of they had all these women, different women, white women, black women, women with babies, who say that they're energy voters, which I found quite humorous.
the oil industry is, you know, the most profitable industry. When you look at the most profitable companies globally, rising to the top will be ExxonMobil, number one, Chevron being number three. When it comes to profits, this is an enormous industry, and they have enormous resources, whether it comes to political contribution or whether it comes to advertising campaigns. There's no one. There's virtually no industry, there's no stakeholder group that can match the enormous resources of this industry. They're everywhere with loads of money, and when you look at the contributions, you can definitely see a lot of unfortunate impacts on politics.
And they're not afraid to use it. I look at the lobbying numbers. I look at the advertising numbers. The money they give to the Heartland Institute and tinky tanks like that, and it's just mind blowing, stuff. Roland, I appreciate the time. Roland Wang, Transportation Program Director with the NRDC, NRDC.org, the website. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Roland's name. Again, thanks so much. I appreciate the info.
Well, thank you for having me on your show.
Anytime. Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Thanks for listening to The Rick Smith Show. We are currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening in Harrisburg and around the globe, be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Rick Smith Show. Remember, a flip comment. He said, I just call up OPEC and I tell him, turn on the spigots. And I remember that, and I'm going, it just doesn't work that way. Especially when you're talking about the developing world coming online and using more energy and using more oil. It's not going to work that way. And I think it's easy to think, well, we're number one and we're the big kahunas. We get what we want because it's the way it's been. But understand, as the rest of the world develops, and especially China, we're going to have to really rethink how we do things in the world. And I came across this article, AFP had an article about this report, this study, whatever it is you want to call it, written by a U.S. And a Chinese scholar. They each took a look, and they each know the other country and how things work. So they came up with and wrote a paper on what they see the future being. And you look at this, and the headline read, Chinese Scholar Sees U.S. Decline. And what this guy Wang Jing says is, he's a professor, the dean of the School of International Studies at Peking University. He wrote in the study that China's strategic distrust of the U.S. is deeply rooted, and in recent years has deepened, because, you know, they want to take over, understand? And they think that we're just grasping at trying to hold on. And what he said, he's like, look, you look at the financial mess that's going on. You look at the deficits. You look at our unemployment rate. You look at the fact that you've got the Republicans who are so far off the beaten path, so far away from reality, that you've got this political polarization that they're looking at this going, you know, look, the U.S. is headed for decline. And this is how the Chinese see this. And I'm thinking about the energy stuff. And I'm going, you know, at some point, the Chinese who are investing heavily, multiple billions of dollars in renewable energy sources, solar and wind and geothermal and tidal and everything you could think of, they're investing in heavily. And they're subsidizing heavily. Why? because they understand if they can become semi-energy independent, they can rule the world. Understand that. It's easy to thump your chest and it's easy to say, oh, we're number one. But when the rest of the world is racing forward, and this is what just drives me nuts. If you look around the world and you bother to take the time to look at what other countries, Germany, for instance, is they want to get rid of their nukes. They want to replace the nuclear power that they've been using the last 20, 30, 40 years. And they want to put renewables. They want to use wind and solar and all the other things that are out there. Smart investment. The Chinese are doing the same thing. Because they get it too. There's only so much oil. Drill, baby, drill can only go so far. So you need to start doing things in a smarter way. And for me, if I had the opportunity, the direction that we would take as a nation is say, you know what? Sorry, no more help for the billionaire oil companies. No more help. You guys are fine. You'll do fine on your own. Because remember, it's about free enterprise. It's about the companies doing well. It's about getting government out. But they want those government handouts, don't they? They want that cheese, man. They want that welfare. Call it whatever you want. It's welfare. I mean, why is it that when we give big, huge corporations who an industry that made $137 billion profit, why do we call those subsidies? But yet when a single mother who's trying to feed her kids and we give her food stamps, why do we call that welfare? And why is that demonized? You know, I look at this and I'm telling you, as we move forward, if we don't have vision and foresight and have the ability, as we have in the past during times of crisis, and I'm telling you, we're in a crisis right now. Oil prices are not going to go down. No matter what Newt Gingrich says, no matter what Romney says, they're not coming down. Because it's an international commodity. And like Roland said, even if we built the Keystone XL pipeline to go into Chicago, like I've said, I could probably support. The cost would probably still go up. Because there's already a pipeline going in there. And I knew that. We're using about half of the capacity of that. So he's right. I mean, the whole purpose of that project is just to get it from where they're landlocked to where they can get it into the international market and make big money. How's that helping you and me? It's not. And I look at this, and if we don't come up with some visionary leaders, and I had hoped Obama was that guy, and maybe in a second term he will be. Maybe he will be that guy who says, you know what, we need to transform this country into one that uses energy smarter. Maybe start rewiring our grids. Maybe make homes energy independent, buildings energy independent. Start pursuing other modes of transportation, mass transit, more fuel-efficient cars as they're doing, but even more so. I mean, you stop and think about it. If we could take that ingenuity, if we could take that national drive, that national pride, like we did, you know, going after the bomb, like we did putting a man on the moon, all of these things that we've done, if we took that and said, you know what, we're getting off the juice. We're going to produce our own energy. As a nation, we're going to be energy independent. And we really, as a nation, said, we're going to stand up and we're going to do this. What could we accomplish? How long would it take us? I mean, it's really a different way of thinking. But is it possible? Is this something? Because I look at this study that they're saying, and look, the Chinese, they're betting, they're banking, they're hoping and praying that we decline. Not enough to where, you know, they can't keep importing their goods into here, but still, they're hoping for our decline. Because then they become the superior power. And I'm not talking about xenophobic. This is reality. This is the way we're going. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around.
Rick Smith Show. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Thanks for listening to the Rick Smith Show. We are currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening in Harrisburg and around the globe, be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Working families at over 100 events today are calling on Congress to immediately repeal the sequester federal budget cuts. The cuts, totaling $1.2 trillion over 10 years, went into effect March 1st. The AFL-CIO says these cuts will cost 750,000 jobs, and Republican hostage takers are demanding more devastating budget cuts that slash more jobs and cut programs that working people need to get back on their feet. AFL-CIO President Rich Trumka says that working people across America have sacrificed enough in the form of lost jobs and furloughed pay. He says it's time for Congress to demand that the corporations in the richest 2% pay their fair share. For a complete list of the events urging sequester repeal today, go to AmericaWantsToWork.org. As workers protest the sequestration cuts, cleanup at nuclear-contaminated sites could be delayed by furloughs triggered by those cuts. Jesse Russell has more.
The sequester cuts are beginning to have an impact on the country's most contaminated nuclear site. More than 2,000 workers at Washington's Hanford Nuclear Reservation received notices this week telling them they'll start being placed on rotating furloughs. 250 workers at the site received pink slips. The furloughs directly impact non-unionized workers at the cleanup site. Due to their contracts, unionized staff have more of a say in how departments can make them take furlough days. The workers are currently removing toxic and radioactive waste from the site in advance of a new treatment facility being constructed. There are some concerns about cleanup being delayed due to a number of underground tanks that are leaking. Hanford is the country's largest cleanup operation, eating up a third of the nation's nuclear cleanup budget.
The SEIU, Black Immigrant Activists, and racial justice organizations are rallying on Capitol Hill in Washington Wednesday to demand that the distinct needs of Caribbean and African immigrants be addressed in any forthcoming immigration reform. SEIU says black immigrants comprise approximately 10% of the foreign-born population, but have been forgotten in the immigration debate. An estimated 700 progressive African Americans and black immigrants from the Caribbean, Africa, Latin America, and throughout the globe will join Clergy United to Save and Heal in the rally. It's being called the Black Communities for Immigrant Justice Rally. U.S. Congresswoman Yvette Clark of New York will give a congressional briefing on the issue. After the rally, the black immigrants will visit key members of Congress working on the immigration reform issue. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the IBEW.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
I am 60 years old. I was born in 1951. I went through the civil rights era, and I'm telling you I'm still here. And if I can stand, you can stand and keep standing.
Show. Yeah, I remember talking to her, Kathy Youngblood. She, the Hyatt situation that was going on out there, the fact that these workers were coming together. And here's a woman who, you know, remembers the civil rights movement, remembers being in the streets, remembers fighting for that dignity, that equality, that respect. And it's gone into the workplace as well. And I don't think they're exclusive. I think the reality is it's, you should be fighting for all your rights. And, you know, I was reading this. Some excerpts from Van Jones' book, this Rebuild the Dream. Change doesn't come without a fight, it's called. And he echoes basically what I've been saying on the program for quite some time. Progress is something that's never really totally achieved. And security is something that's never totally achieved. It's a constant struggle with people who have to remain vigilant, engaged, active, informed. And he was talking some about the Tea Party, and he's right. No one stood up to them in the streets. They were out there screaming all the nonsense they were, but there was nobody pushing back. And I remember at the time calling for labor and civil rights leaders to meet them in the streets and push back on the insanity. And I think now is the time we're seeing this going on. And today being the anniversary of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, you know, the question then becomes, that equality that they were fighting for, are we any closer? That's why I've asked the Dr. Robert Wydell, Associate Assistant Professor at the University of Rhode Island, to come talk to us. Dr. Wydell, thanks for taking time for me.
Hi, good to be here.
You know, I look at, the people who are on the streets now, the Occupy movement, the folks who are out protesting the murder of Trayvon Martin, all of this opportunity to engage people, all of this opportunity to organize, I think it's the right time.
Yeah, I think you're right. Now, one of the things that, a lot of historians have commented on that happened, in the late 1970s and into the 1980s with both civil rights and some labor organizing is that there was this sort of lack of attention to the grassroots, and people getting out in the streets and people getting out and really organizing at that grassroots level. And I think that's part of, clearly there's some big economic things going on and a big, shift to conservatism in the United States. We can't ignore that, but there's also some ways in which, there was some momentum that was lost. And I think, that with things like the Occupy movement and with things like, what's happening with the Trayvon Martin case, and so on, that you're beginning to see, really some of that grassroots kind of action that most movements are built on.
I look back and of course today, looking at the fact that today was the day that MLK was murdered, and you look at what he was part of and how the movement continued on, even without him, and I look at the Occupy movement and some of the other things, pretty much what I would say kind of a leaderless movement, a movement of people and this groundswell from the bottom.
Yeah, it is. And, and I think that, what we often lose sight of is, and my students are always very surprised to find this, is that, the civil rights movement was not simply Martin Luther King, and he, was one figure, one very important figure, and it was an amazing, person in the stuff that he contributed and the sacrifices that he made and the way that he could mobilize and speak, for a community. But when you really read about what was happening with the movement, it was, everyday folk in rural Mississippi and in Atlanta and in New York and in, places across the country that in their own communities and mobilizing amongst their own, in their own churches and in their own labor halls and in their own, fraternal organizations and the like, that, that these were the folks that really drove what was going on. And it was their concerns that really animated what was happening in the movement. And it's that, I think that is in some ways what I find sort of encouraging about things like the Occupy movement is that people are discovering that you don't need some big spokesperson, that is going to, sort of take you to the promised land, that in fact you can do that for yourself. And that King was himself brought into the movement by, the actions of everyday folks in Montgomery. And they brought him in and he turned out to be a wonderful, wonderful person to bring in.
Right.
But, he's sort of brought into this by the grassroots himself. And he would have been, I think, the first person to acknowledge that.
And you look at one of the reasons he was down in the southern part of the country was because of a labor situation, the garbage workers there in Memphis. And I think most people forget that this was a workers' rights as well as civil rights, issue.
Yeah. That's the biggest sort of tragedy of the way that we remember King is that most people, remember King for his, I Have a Dream speech at the March on Washington and this notion of being judged by the content of your character rather than the color of your skin. And that, in fact, is part of what he was saying, but he was also very, vehement about the need for a redistribution of wealth and power in the United States. And he was very vehement about the need to support the rights of workers to organize and he was very vehement about the right of looking out for the rights of poor people and and the like. And you know, that gets lost in some of the conversation, and some of that's deliberate. I mean, you know, there's a very deliberate effort by folks on the right in, you know, starting in the 1970s to take that, you know, notion of colorblindness and turn it to their advantage and make this about, you know, something that's going to support conservative causes and the like. And, you know, King would have very much been against that. And so, you know, I think what we absolutely need to recognize, as we do today, but, you know, even, you know, throughout the rest of the year is, you know, the kind of stuff that he was doing in Memphis. I mean, he was there on behalf of those, you know, black sanitation workers.
Yep.
And, you know, they, you know, and in fact, in Memphis after that, you know, that some of the legacy of that is you see lots of, you know, labor organizing in the late 60s and in the early part of the 1970s, AFSCME and various other groups that are continuing some of that legacy. That was definitely part of what King was about.
Yeah, and what he left behind were active and engaged, informed people who became the activists in their communities. And as I remember things and what I try and really remember is he was about economic justice. He was about equality. But also, you know, moving forward on that thing that the Republicans love to tell me, that this is a Christian nation, and actually, you know, maybe living that legacy in a certain way.
Yeah, you know, and, for King, you know, his Christianity, and that you look out for the least among you, and that you, you know, you empower those who don't have power. And, you know, that is, you know, that's a very different message than what you get from some of the right-wing versions of Christianity today, where it's about individual gain and it's about personal success and it's about building yourself up. And you know, that is not the kind of social justice Christianity that someone like King, you know, represented, certainly. You know, and, you know, to follow up on that and some of the stuff we were just talking about, you know, I think, you know, what is, you know, what we also need to remember is that, you know, there was all kinds of stuff that was going on in the late 60s and in the early 1970s that, you know, happens after King is assassinated. And, you know, that has to do with efforts to address economic concerns and address, you know, issues of economic inequality in the United States. And, you know, a lot of that gets sort of defeated and stamped out. And a lot of that is, you know, very deliberate, again, on part of this conservative effort. But, you know, those were all part of that civil rights legacy that, you know, we often don't acknowledge.
Right. Do you see that we're in kind of a similar situation, though? Because, you know, I looked at 2010 and one of the statistics that's just stuck in my mind is that 93% of all income gains in this nation went to the top 1%. So there was a recovery that was going on. It's just that, well, the vast majority of us, 99% of us, barely saw any of the recovery. So do you think people are realizing that, you know what, the game's rigged, that we've been allowed to be sliced and diced and pitted against one another, white, black, union, non-union, white collar, blue collar, all the ways they divide us. Do you think now's the opportunity, or from what you're seeing, of people to kind of set aside some of those differences and focus on, well, that 93% of the income gains going to the top 1%.
Yeah, you know, I think I think this is an important moment. And, you know, part of, I think part of what has to be a necessary part of that as well is some of the organizing that's going on around, trying to either, you know, overturn or somehow get around this Citizens United decision.
Right.
You know, that allows so much corporate money to come into and affect elections. And what, you know, the result of all of that is that you've got, you know, folks in Congress, whether they're Republican or Democrat, that are just slaves to money and slaves to money that's coming in from Wall Street and from enormous banks and corporations and the like. And until people feel like they actually have, you know, a degree of power and that they can make some sort of change, then, you know, it's really hard to get them to go out and to mobilize and to push for these kinds of things. And when people don't have that kind of inspiration, and that, you know, again, you know, the Occupy movement is really important. If it doesn't do anything else, you know, from here on out, it's important because think about the way that the conversation in just in the United States changed.
Absolutely.
As a result of what they were doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, what are we talking about, you know, a year before that? We're talking about the Tea Party stuff, and we're talking about, you know, all these other kinds of of issues. And now, you know, this idea of a 99%, everybody knows what that is. You know, nobody's not heard of that. And the publicity that they brought and the attention they brought to this issue of economic inequality, absolutely, I think, is raised and heightened, you know, awareness of these kinds of issues.
Yeah, and really, you look at what they've done, and it's been just terrific in changing the conversation, as you've said, and highlighting some of the mass inequality. Because I think most people that, you know, they're struggling to get by. They've got their head down. I can't get involved in this. But at some point, you've got to wake up and realize that we're all in this together. And if you're not seated at the table, you're probably on the menu.
Right. You know, and what's encouraging for me as well is that, you know, I begin to see some recognition of this amongst my students as well, and that they're sort of, this is sort of filtering down to them as well. And we, you know, it wasn't always the case. You know, I'd say 10 years ago, the students in my classroom, they weren't as engaged, you know, as I'm starting to see them be now. So maybe that's a hopeful sign as well, that, you know, that getting some young people involved in this is also part of the legacy of what happens with Occupy.
Yeah, well, I got to think that it's because they've awakened to the fact that they're screwed. They're taking out huge amounts of student loan debt. They're being saddled with all this debt, and when they get out, most of the time there's no job waiting there. I mean, 10 years ago there was a job waiting, at least something you could get to make a living on. But right now, the way I'm seeing things. And here, if Congress does nothing in the next couple of weeks, the interest rate on the debt that they're taking out is about to double.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really important thing that all college students should be concerned about is just the staggering amount of debt that they're graduating with, and no job to pay it off, right? You know, and so I think, you know, The reality, the economic realities of right now of all these folks that are graduating with this kind of debt, and they've got debt, maybe even working to put themselves through college, and they're still coming out with this, you know, staggering amount of debt and nothing to show for it. I think that really is mobilizing them. And so some of the efforts to reform and to change some of the things around student loans is an important piece of what's happening too.
Yeah, you know, I look at all of this and I'm hoping you're seeing, as you've said, the awakening, because you look at the war on workers, you look at the war on women, you look at the war on students, all of this stuff where the right sees this as their time for total domination, and I'm hoping this summer is going to be one of those times where people are in the streets.
Yeah, you know, and I think what's important about this moment now is that, you know, my understanding and the way that I think about what happens with this conservative resurgence of the 1970s into the 1980s with the Reagan Revolution is that, you know, these are the folks that are leading that, you know, march are, they go way back in terms of the kinds of, you know, opposition they had to the New Deal and to labor and to, you know, all these kinds of things that stretch back, you know, even, you know, to the progressive movement, right? You know, and some of the, you know, the reforms there about, you know, working conditions and wages and the like. And, you know, these are long, you know, animosities that they've had. But what they're able to do in the 1970s so effectively is to take all that stuff and weld it to this anti-communism Cold War stuff that's still going on, and weld it to the social conservative anti-abortion and evangelical Christianity and the like, and they're able to take people that, you know, were supportive of some of these other things and bring them into the conservative fold and get them, you know, voting and putting in place people that have no intention of putting in some of these socially conservative kinds of policies in place.
Yep.
You know, and, you know, Reagan, you know, is president and abortion is still legal, and Bush is president and abortion is still legal, you know, and, you know, what's happening now, gay marriage is, you know, is on the agenda and in ways that it wasn't before. And, you know, people are, you know, they're not changing in terms of those social and cultural kinds of ways. And so I think that what is happening now is that some of those things aren't resonating with people as much as they were before. And when people look around and they see the kind of economic, you know, conditions in which we are now, and they also, you know, particularly with young people, are more and more open to, you know, the ideas of, the women's movement and the gay and lesbian rights movement and the civil rights movement and so on, that those things are less able to divide people. And so, you know, what you fall back on is you're trying to make some arguments. If you're a conservative, you're trying to make some arguments about, you know, economic privilege, you know, and the like. That, you know, increasingly people are not going to be willing to listen to.
Right. You know, all those issues you laid out there. I mean, I've been saying for the longest time that's the shiny thing. That's the diversion. That's the thing to keep people stupid while they're basically pilfering from our wallets.
Yeah, you know, that's the hopeful thing is I think you see some splintering of that, you know, and the thing that keeps me from being a little more hopeful about it is the influence of money, you know, and I think someone like, you know, what Bill Moyers has been doing on his show that he's brought back and really investigating the impact of money on American politics and so on is a really important thing that, you know, and it's something that has to be addressed.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the fact that this Republican primary here, they've all got their billionaires who are all out there pushing them. I mean, what did Adelson give Gingrich? $10 million?
Right. You know, unfortunately for me, I guess, you know, Gingrich found a way to make being a historian into, you know, $1 million career, which I haven't been able to do yet with some of his work.
Oh, I can tell you why that is. You probably stick to the facts. You probably stick to history. He's all about rewriting it.
Right.
You know, the reinventing it. I just got a pitch for a book the other day. Somebody wants to come out and talk about their book where they're looking at the homestead strike through the eyes of a scab. And, you know, I'm just going, no, that's just not going to happen. But it is, it is what it is. And as I've been saying, they want to repeal the whole 20th century and take us back to the good old days of the 90s, back to the 1890s. Dr. Wydell, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the thoughts, the information. I'd love to have you back on again real soon.
Absolutely. I enjoyed having you, or being there, and I'd love to come back on.
Thanks so much. Dr. Robert Wydell, assistant professor at the University of Rhode Island. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Thanks for listening. We are currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening in Harrisburg and around the globe, be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Rick Smith Show.
Sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed, with your arrogance, your ignorance, and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
And welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. So, Waukesha County, Wisconsin. Again, you remember back, you know, during the Supreme Court election there in Wisconsin, back about a year ago, there was this woman who, you know, she decided she was going to take her computer home, and that computer had, well, 14,000 votes on it that hadn't been bothered to be counted, or so we're led to believe. And the woman who was running against Prosser was declared the winner based on the results that they had at that moment. Then the next day, well, you know, we found these 14,000 votes on this woman's laptop that she just took home with her. And, you know, honest mistake, could have happened to anybody. Well, it turns out the county clerk there in Waukesha County, a woman named Kathy Nicholas, well, she's kind of done it again. And you know, look, at the end of the day, I think they need someone new. I guess she's up for re-election and probably hasn't done herself any good because, again, some problems. Didn't post the elections results in a timely fashion. In fact, she was about 6 hours late. What had happened was, is, you know, they had some technology in place and then, oh, oops, something went wrong. And then they had to manually put every vote total for every candidate in every race in every municipality in by hand, and then proof them against what they got from the voting machines before they got to post them online. She said, you know, the process was slower than we had anticipated. The 6 hours, slower than she had anticipated. I'm telling you, folks, competency. That's something maybe you should ask for in your county clerk. Just a little thought, little advice for the folks of Wisconsin. Since she has had her problems with the voting thing. Also, in Minnesota, they're going to be deciding in November whether you're going to have government-issued IDs for voters. You know, it seems to be the wave across the country. And I guess this is one way that, you know, fine, you know, people are okay with it. You take it to the ballot. There's part of me that says, yeah, that's probably the way to go. I don't want a handful of radical legislators pushing it through. But at the end of the day, I still look at this as you have a constitutional right to the ballot box. I don't know that I want roadblocks to that. Just a thought. I mean, you know, and every person that you tell that to, when you really lay it out and say, look, you know, that the argument that I have to have an ID to rent a car or, you know, rent a hotel room or any of that stuff or get on a plane, you don't have a constitutional right to that. And I've told probably 20 people that. And right at the moment where I go, you know, you don't have a right to rent a car, or you don't have a right to a hotel, you could see in their eyes, like a light bulb goes on, like, yeah, that makes sense. And I look at this and I say, you know, the people that this is going to affect, people like my grandmother, who hasn't driven in years, or people like this 87-year-old who said, you know, this 87-year-old woman who said couldn't make it, you know, back from the polls. She was disenfranchised by a poll worker. She wasn't going to be able to get back and forth. And I look at the woman down south who's like 90 years old. They don't have marriage certificates that go back that far for her. And they say, well, gee, you know, your name changed. We don't have record of that. So now you can't vote. But yes, you are a citizen. We know where you live. We know who you are. You're not a citizen. And you stop and you think about all this stuff. And while it seems real simple, oh, you just show your ID. Everyone's got one, right? Wrong. Everyone doesn't have one. And the whole purpose of this is pretty simple. It's to hold down the vote. It's pretty simple. It's for the Republicans to maintain power. And this is another one of those issues. I mean, there are tons of issues right now for people to rally around. I mean, you look at the contraception thing. You got Nikki Haley saying, well, you know, contraception. Well, women don't care about that. You know, I've talked to a bunch of women who, you know, when you ask them, and I did, do you care about contraception? Yes. I care about the government not telling me what I can and cannot do. I care about the government telling me that I can't get it from my employer. I can't have access to services if I choose and my doctor and I choose to go that route. And what's kind of interesting to me is you've got these conservative women, and part of me thinks they're all on the payroll, saying, oh, no, we're energy voters. This morning, you know, before we went over to the Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference, I flipped on CNN and a couple other stations as I was flipping through, and the money the oil and gas industry is spending on ads is just mind-blowing. And what they're trying to get women to stop thinking about the attacks against women. All of the attacks on contraception and on abortion and all the other things, and try and change their mind into thinking, well, you know, we're energy voters. So I kept seeing this ad that just, you know, just, it was just amazing. And I thought, you know what? Let me quick play this.
This election's about jobs. Millions of people are out of work. Developing more energy here is vital to turning this economy around.
Yeah.
We've got to do it. I'm Kelsey, and I'm an energy voter.
Yeah, I'm an energy voter. Never mind that you're trying to, you know, stick your laws in my uterus. No, I'm an energy voter. That's what's really important. And even though, you know, we've talked about it a number of times on this program, even if we drill, baby, drilled everything we got, like Roland Wang said, not going to do us any good. Even if we build the pipeline through the center of the country, not going to do us any good. And that's the division. That's the shiny stuff. That's what keeps us from reality. That's what keeps us from going, hey, wait a second. 93% of all income gains ended up in the hands of the top 1%. Really? How's that fair? You know, I look at this thing with Hostess, and tomorrow I'm hoping to get to the bottom of this. Their CEOs and their executives all took massive raises. The CEO got, what, a 300% raise? Because they stopped the meritocracy. They weren't based on performance. It was based on, hey, there's a bunch of money here. Let's steal it. Let's loot the coffers before the ship goes down. I mean, imagine if the captain of the Titanic did like the guy in the Italian cruise ship. Hey, screw you guys. I'm getting out of here. And I'm taking everything, the lifeboats and everything with me. Which are what these CEOs are doing. Which is what the Romneys of the world have done. And then they tell us that's business? It's nuts. And this idea, oh, I'm an energy voter. Yeah, me too. I'd like to make the country energy independent. I'd like us to get off of the dirty stuff, the burning stuff. I'd like us to, oh, I don't know, think about my children and my grandchildren and think about the folks in the future. That's just a thought. Maybe not a good one in conservative world, but a thought. And if we had public transportation, if we had mass transit, we could move people around. Get people off the highway so I don't sit in traffic for an hour going into Philadelphia. And look, there's no way that I could commute into Philadelphia. I mean, and it's getting that way here. Understand, in 10, 15 years, this area is going to continue to grow. As is the nation. Right now, we need to be looking at how are we going to plan for the future as the nation grows, as the number of people multiply. How are you going to move those people around? How are you going to build communities and connect them and get people from home to work and to shopping and all the things that they do? How are you going to do that? Because our highway system not going to handle it. Unless you're going to start building highways on top of highways on top of highways, and then good luck. I've seen that. New York is not a nice place to travel around. New York's another place. And they've got fairly decent public transportation, as does Philadelphia. But for the most part, yeah, if you live outside of town, there's no way in. We need to be looking at different ideas, at bigger ideas. We need visionaries. We don't need politicians. We don't need people who are worrying about the next election. We need folks who are going to think about, what's this country going to look like in 20 years? What's life going to be like in 20 years? And what's amazing to me is we've done this to ourselves. We don't have, there's part of me that says our education system has almost deliberately made it to where we don't have big thinkers anymore. You look at all of the colleges that have done away with humanities and the arts and done away with a lot of philosophy and a lot of those majors and degrees and departments, and concentrated on, well, this is your particular skill, and we need trained workers. We need good worker bees with good skills, not big thinkers. I'm of the mindset that education should be both. Should be training people to do a job, but still being big problem-solving, critical thinkers. Because if we were as a society, you know, there's part of me that says, you know, we could solve these problems. And we wouldn't be yelling slogans and bumper sticker slogans at each other across a room. Just a thought. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. We're on the road.
America. Rick Smith.
Thanks for listening to the Rick Smith Show. We are currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening in Harrisburg and around the globe, be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Rick Smith Show.
Apparently, Representative Paul Ryan missed the outcome of last November's presidential election. Oh, wait, wasn't he on the ballot in that election as Mitt Romney's running mate? Well, yes, but less than 5 months later, Ryan seems to have forgotten that he and the Mitster were soundly rejected. Maybe the trauma of losing, including losing his own hometown of Janesville, Wisconsin, has caused his memory slippage. Whatever the cause, it's embarrassing to see him now trotting out the very same Republican budget proposal that he wrote last year and put at the center of the Romney-Ryan national campaign. The same nauseating budget extremism that induced the great majority of Americans to upchuck. Ryan recently headlined a Washington media event for the re-release of this bucket of right-wing hash. It includes turning Medicare into a we-don't-care privatized voucher system that would deliver seniors into the tender clutches of giant insurance corporations, forcing the elderly to pay more for less. Also, in order to save the super-rich from even the slightest tax increase, Ryan again serves up a mess of cuts to food stamps, Medicaid, and other vital programs for the poor, while simultaneously jacking up the tax burden on both the poor and the middle class. Then, to make his package even more odious to the general public, he cluelessly reissues the far-right's cry to repeal Obamacare. Hello, Paul. Reality calling. Obama thoroughly thumped you and Mitt on this issue last year, remember? And since the election, Obamacare has grown in popularity, with several Republican governors now seeing the political light and embracing Obama's signature health care reform. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's time for family and friends to circle around Paul Ryan for a sanity intervention, gently trying to pull him out of the rabbit hole he's got himself stuck in.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
So the president signed into law the Stock Act, again, reforming rules on insider trading for our beloved members of Congress. The president said it would help deal with the deficit of trust that seems to be afflicting Washington. I mean, when Congress has got an approval rating of about 10%, I don't know how it could hurt. My question is, are there any teeth? When we catch them, will we see perp walks? That's what I want. Pretty simple stuff. Anyway, I've got Justin Duckham on the phone, Talk Radio News Service. Justin, thanks for taking time for me.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So we've passed and signed the Grand New Stock Act to where we're going to hold our members of Congress almost accountable as you and I are accountable.
Exactly. That's what the president tried to say today. You know, this was, as he tried to promote it, a bipartisan piece of legislation that was championed by both Democrats and by Republicans after there was a pretty compelling 60 Minutes report. And he went out there today and tried to cast this as a necessary step to rebuild trust between D.C. and the rest of the nation, but he acknowledged that there is still work that needs to be done. This does have teeth in some sense, but there are some glaring omissions, such as information brokers don't have to register as lobbyists and can still theoretically perform some insider trading type deals. But as the president said, and you know, a lot of people who push for the original passage of this have said, this is a promising first step.
Yeah. For me, you know, you look at a lot of the sweetheart deals that you see, the mortgages, the all the stuff that comes along with it, and people, I understand people's frustration, man.
I mean, certainly. When it came out, it was a pretty shocking piece of evidence, you know. A lot of people didn't really give it much thought that, you know, people are, you know, it seems obvious that people are in Congress for their own means and not always for their constituents, but, you know, it was never as blatant as it was with that report.
Yeah, absolutely. So Nancy Pelosi is holding a hearing, I understand?
Yes, the Congress is out of session, but she held a hearing today with the Democratic Steering Committee. which is the latest in a series that Democrats have been doing to sort of get their side of the story out there in the Republican-controlled House. And this one today was on oil speculation and pretty much brought up a league of experts to argue that it wasn't just Iran and it wasn't just the lack of drilling, as Republicans are saying, that are raising gas prices, but rather, you know, more Wall Street than anything else, saying that a lot of these merchants out there are really betting on catastrophe and have driven it up through those means.
Yeah, I mean, in betting against it, you know, betting that the price will go up is a sucker's bet, really. I mean, you look at all of the things that could go wrong and all of the thought processes going that way. And beyond that, beyond the speculation, the fact is that more people are using it. More people in China, more people in India, we should be moving to alternatives. I don't know how much simpler it has to be. I don't know how much easier I have to lay it out.
You know, that's a good point. But, you know, a lot of Americans have a pretty, you know, warped view of how, you know, supply and demand works and don't understand that we have quite a bit of oil and that we have a lot less oil than the world needs underneath our own soil.
Yeah, so, I mean, drill baby drill only works so much if you can drill enough to feed all of the insatiable appetite of the globe. You know, this whole, because as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, we are drilling more now than we did during the Bush years.
We are. And that is something that, you know, the Democrats have been trying to really put in the forefront, but just isn't really catching on. There's a sense that Obama is anti-drilling when really he's betrayed quite a few of his, you know, green colleagues by, you know, absolutely promoting more drilling.
Yeah, I look at this, and again, you go back to this whole the whole Keystone XL pipeline thing and all of, you know, that I hear the Republicans keep saying it's going to save us price. It's going to bring the prices down. It's going to save the country. How? It's going to just end up in the international market. I mean, if you want my support, build the pipeline to Chicago, pass a law that says everything that comes in stays here. And then I might be for it.
No, it's a very good point. And that's something that a lot of people don't mention. And even those who are supporters of the pipeline, didn't really wander into that territory. They tried to make it just about jobs and less about energy, which it really was, you know, because that would have been a losing narrative for them to point out that this would have been, you know, sending oil overseas and not really doing much to help the American economy.
Yep. So last night, the big hat trick for Mitt Romney. Is this a new theme of his? I must have heard him say government-centered society like 100 times during his speech. Is this something new?
It's not necessarily new. You know, he's been trying, like the rest of the Republican field, to place Obama as sort of a nanny government-like figure. But it certainly rings a new bell for what the 2012 election is going to look like. He didn't need to mention Santorum. He went strictly after Obama and was sort of test-driving some of the themes that he's likely going to be using in the general election.
Yeah, you know, I heard someone on CNN talking about, well, do you think he's going to stop paying attention to the other candidates? And I'm going, I thought he had already done that. I thought he had pretty much done away with the other candidates because if I were him, I would.
I know, and that's something that he, for the most part, has done for the most of this for the bulk of this campaign. When he started out, he, you know, was very rightfully treating himself as the ultimate winner. And right now it's back to that as usual. He has been trying to portray himself as the de facto nominee for quite some time, and that was what the bulk of the strategy was built on. You know, he wasn't necessarily ready to really tumble with Gingrich or, you know, Santorum or, you know, the myriad of other less serious candidates we had in the field who had their brief 15 minutes of fame.
So do you think Gingrich is ever going to fall out of this? I mean, will he be running, you know, long after November? Because the way I'm looking at it, the guy's never going to quit, and I give him credit for that. You know, you got to believe, I guess. You know, maybe he can get bus fare to the next state primary.
You know, I don't think Gingrich is a rational actor. You know, we saw in the beginning of the race that he wasn't taking it very seriously. You know, was halting things to go on vacation, and even pretty late into it was doing bizarre things like campaigning in Hawaii or California, which was still you know, months off. And at the same time, he was also demanding to be taken seriously as a presidential candidate. And really thought of himself as a front runner or as a leading candidate, even though he wasn't really acting like it. So I don't know what Gingrich's logic is, if he actually has any. So, you know, whether or not he can be appeased or really, you know, see the writing on the wall, just remains to be seen. And it doesn't look like he's somebody who can really get the hint.
Yeah, because it looks like, you know, all of the reporters have left him. Most of his staff have left. The money has dried up. What's left to tell him the party's over?
Pretty much exactly. I mean, there's no feasible strategy where he could really get the nomination. What he's banking on right now is coming into a brokered convention as a, you know, white knight who is going to be lifted up by, you know, the Republican masses into this leadership position. And
yeah, that ain't going to happen.
That's so detached from reality. That is
that's not going to happen. If you go into a brokered convention, I think you're going to get a player that nobody's seen before. You're going to get, you know, somebody like Bush or someone like, you know, Jindal or Daniels or someone like that. I don't think any Snow White or the other seven dwarfs, I don't think you're going to see any of them.
No, exactly. I mean, you're going to, it's not going to happen on one hand. But if it did happen, it's going to be somebody who's an adult in the party who is already loved and doesn't come with the baggage and the animosity that Gingrich brings. And there's no shortage of better candidates than Gingrich for a broker convention.
And I guess lastly on this topic, is Ron Paul still running? I haven't heard any insanity out of him lately.
He's still running. He's doing a lot less than even his more pragmatic supporters believe. And it's hard to account for why that really is going in that direction. You know, one of the theories that I've been bouncing around is that a lot of these primaries are closed, and I just don't think that many of his supporters are actually registered Republicans. I think the bulk of them are probably Democrats who decided to have a complete 180 with their views. But at the end of the day, he's not doing very well. Last night, he just got about 11% of the vote, which is still more than Newt Gingrich, but still pretty far off from somebody who is really, you know, seems to be in this all the way to Tampa.
Yeah, it's really just amazing stuff. And I mean, I'm still hoping Pennsylvania is relevant. I'm happy to hear Santorum's going to stay in it as long as he can, because again, I'd like to. In fact, Mitt's going to be here in Harrisburg tomorrow evening, right down just a couple of blocks from where our studio is. So we may go stop and wave, you know, wave happy thoughts to him.
No, it's going to be interesting. You know, there's going to be 20 days for him to campaign in Santorum's home turf, and that's really where he's going to be putting all of his focus. I think it's going to be a pretty dirty battle down there. We're likely going to see, or I'm not going to see, but you're going to be inundated with negative ads. And, you know, at the end of the day, he very well could send enough resources to eke out an election, you know, especially since Santorum is not necessarily a beloved figure. He has about a 6-point lead right now in the state, but that can shift very easily.
Yep.
And he has a history of losing not very long ago in the Keystone State.
Well, I mean, when he got thumped in the 2006 election by Bob Casey, 17 points, he was extreme at the time. He has now doubled that extreme. He is even further to the radical right than he was back in 2006. So, you know, I'm hoping that the rational people of the Republican Party here in Pennsylvania look at him and go, boy, you were crazy in 2006, which is why we didn't vote for you. You're even crazier now, and they walk away from him.
Well, and he's been trying to say that he can appeal to blue-collar Democrats and, you know, people who are on the fence. But really, he does not have the rhetoric or the plan or just the, you know, the general decorum of being somebody who is really a moderate. He's, you know, really portrayed himself as the most extreme candidate, and I think that has a chance of coming back to bite him in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, because he couldn't even come back to reality if he ever got the nomination. Just not possible. And lastly, there looks like there may be a trial at Guantanamo Bay.
Exactly, the KSM trial, which. You know, for a brief shining moment, they were trying to have through civilian courts on U.S. soil, now will be taking place in Guantanamo Bay. This will be through a Capitol Military Commission, which means that the five suspected co-conspirators will be facing the death penalty at the end of the day. You know, it looks like the Republicans won the battle with that, and it's not taking place on American soil.
Yeah, well, we're gonna give them a fair trial before we hang them.
that's what they say, but, you know, it's worth noting that Obama's already gone on the record and said that KSM is going to get the death penalty. And even today, the Pentagon press release had sort of lip service saying that, you know, they're innocent until proven guilty. But the headline for the release was pretty pure and simple and said 9/11 co-conspirators charged. And, not 9/11 suspects charged.
Right. We shall see where this takes us. Justin Duckham, always great talking with you. Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much.
Have a good one, Rick.
Well, let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Democracy. I don't believe
it. Bringing sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
Thanks for listening to The Rick Smith Show. We are currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening in Harrisburg and around the globe, be sure to like our Facebook page at facebook.com/Rick Smith Show.
Sanity and rational thought back to America. Rick Smith.
I'm ready. Ready as anybody can be. I'm ready.
Oh, yes. Yes, the old Muddy Waters song. Muddy Waters. Born McKinley Morganfield in Clarksdale, Mississippi, on this day back in 1913. Some just fantastic, as a blues fan, just some fantastic songs that turned out to be, you know, some big rock songs as well. I mean, that version there is done by a guy named Lucky Peterson. But you go back and you look at, you know, Mannish Boy, Hoochie Coochie Man, You Shook Me, Rolling Stone, I Just Want to Make Love to You, you know, so many great songs. I mean, just, and you think about it and you go, here was a guy just made fantastic music. And got screwed over by the labels, and they got corporations taking advantage of people. And you go back, you know, during that whole time, you know, during all of the, you know, the middle years, up until really recently, where people started, you know, making sure that they owned the licensing and owned the copyrights to their lyrics, they all got screwed. Just about every one of them. And you know, a lot of those old blues guys, they really took it on the chin, is what it is. But I love the music. Anyway, welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any of the program, download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app. Tonight on the program, we talked with our good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, about the prevailing theft, if you will, as the legislators here in Pennsylvania talk about how can we make sure that the economy does not recover? How can we make sure that workers work for less and their bosses make more? I guess that's the easiest way of putting it, because we know and we've seen time and time again, study after study, none of the states that have done away with prevailing wage, none of them have lowered costs, and the workers, well, they got screwed. And I guess that's the plan. That is the probably number one, or maybe number two, on the Republican platform this time around. Also on the program tonight, we talked with Larry Handley, president of the Amalgamated Transit Union, ATU.org, about the day of action today with Occupy Wall Street, as they highlight the fact that we need jobs, we need mass public transit, and there's a way, you know what? There's a way to create jobs. Build a rail system, build a transportation system. You know, we can't even get a simple transportation bill out of Congress. We're getting nothing out of the state level, other than public-private partnerships, which means we're going to take our tax dollars, give it to private interests, and they're going to benefit off it. Real nice. We also talked with Roland Wang from the NRDC. He's their transportation program director, about the high cost of oil and how do we bring it down? Not surprising, we don't. You can drill, baby, drill all you want. You can suck every ounce of oil out from under our feet, which we control 2% of the world's oil reserves. Not going to move the needle one iota. In fact, we are drill, baby, drilling more than we did during the Bush years. And I was thinking about that. I remember Bush. We're just going to tell, we're going to call up OPEC, get him on the phone, tell him, turn on the spigots. How'd that work out? Not so well. We also talked with Dr. Robert Wydell, assistant professor at the University of Rhode Island, about today being the anniversary of Dr. King's assassination. And what came out of that? I mean, after King was assassinated, did the entire movement fall apart? Was he what made that movement, or was he just a spokesperson, a person out in front? Because, you know, when you look at things that go on, these movements that happen, it's not about individuals. It's about the group. It's about everybody. And I'm hoping in the coming weeks, in the coming months, we see more people becoming enraged and coming together. And not following one person, but following an idea, a principle, a thought, and pushing for that. We should have equality in this nation. We should be seeking for income equality. We should be seeking health care for everyone. And if this health care law gets overturned, what are you going to do? You know, are you going to take to the streets? Because if I remember right, 2008, the mandate was we need to get health care for people. And now the situation's worse. And I hear Romney running around saying, well, this president has lost more jobs than everyone. Yeah, but this president is the first guy to walk into office in a free fall. The nation was in free fall. When they handed over the keys, there was a 1,000-pound rock attached to it. And they were standing on water. We were absolutely in free fall. I mean, remember that. That's important. Because in September of 2008, we were off the cliff. We were losing hundreds of thousands of jobs every single month and getting progressively worse. Until in February, we lost something like 800,000 jobs in 1 month. And by doing the Recovery Act, by saying, you know what, we need to stop this. We need to stabilize. You know, when you're bleeding, when you've got an open wound, what's the first thing you do? Well, you stop the bleeding. And that's what we did. And I think it's important to remember that. So when I see Romney run around and say, this guy, he lost more jobs than anybody, understand why. You take out those first couple of months when the nation was in free fall. He can't say that. Because he's hoping that you forget that this is a Republican cause situation. This is the conservative ideology. And Democrats going along with that conservative ideology. This is them saying, well, you know what? We're going to deregulate because the banks learned their lesson. And we're hearing the same thing about our environment. Oh, the polluters, they've learned their lesson. We shouldn't regulate them. Nonsense. They haven't learned their lesson. The reason that you can say that is there's somebody watching. Simple stuff. Anyway, of course, like I said, if you missed any portion of the program, ricksmithshow.com, you can download the podcast. Or if you have a smartphone, get the Stitcher app, and you can take the program on the go. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to talk to someone from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters about this hostess thing, which just my head's about to explode over. The fact that the CEO who knows, these executives who know that they're filing bankruptcy, they just kind of change their compensation to where they can load their pockets and loot the treasury before the ship goes down. Amazing, amazing stuff. But that's Romney's America. We'll see you tomorrow night. Have a great one.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Thanks for listening to the Rick Smith Show. We are currently moving to a new, better studio that will allow us to bring new features to the show. We'll be back next week with fresh content talking about the attacks on workers today. In the meantime, enjoy some of our best programming from last year's attacks. To keep updated with what's happening,